Okay, guys, welcome back to the... That sounds like every single instructor at the beginning of a class. Am I just using that same... I'm pretty sure I say that as well. Okay, guys, come in, come in. Oh, Jesus Christ. Today on the Roz Rate podcast, I am joined by Paul Bridges. Paul is about as old school UK Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu as you can get, as you'll find all about as we go through this episode. But he was back training in the mid-90s, so really at the early stages of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in the UK. Paul now is a black belt under Mauricio Gomez, and he runs Gracie Baja Hastings. So we have a really, really cool chat. And talking about all sorts of stuff. He was training way back in the day before there was any Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu really in the UK properly. He went over to America and he was training in America for a little while. Opening his own gym, how he's running that, his kids training, how he manages to juggle all of that family life and sort of everything else. And then still trying to compete. He was on Polaris a little while ago and still looking to compete at those sort of levels now. So I had a really, really cool chat with Paul. Really, really enjoyed this. And I hope you guys enjoy it as much as I did. So, Paul, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You're big in the comic books.
Comic books, yeah.
Talk to me.
Yeah, I've loved comics since before it was cool.
Cool to like comics, but before films came out.
Yeah. Yeah, because now it's kind
everyone
of...
Everyone thinks they're a nerd.
Everyone, yeah. No, but I've collected comics. But I don't anymore, funnily enough, but I used to, when I was younger, I used to collect comics all the time and buy them and stuff like that. My dad used to buy them for me, and I got quite a big collection and stuff like that, and always used to draw comics and... yeah, anything from DC to Marvel to 2000 AD, everything I used to just love it before, you know, and especially when I was a teenager and I still used to like go to the, you know, kind of corner shop and yeah. See what they had in comics and buy them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But you would never tell your friends that you I've got the latest like Superman, Batman, and this so is like, happening, because you'd be like... Really?
Because you'd be like, it was a bad thing to be a geek back then.
Well, it's only, I mean, only recently is it cool. Bit like BJJ, only recently is it cool.
Yeah.
Like,
but I don't think anyone was getting picked on for being a badass grappler back in the day.
No.
So like, okay, you've got we're talking beforehand, you've got an 8-year-old son, yeah?
Yeah.
Is he into comic books?
He's just started drawing stuff, because that's a big passion of mine since I've been young is... art and drawing, especially like graphic art, fantasy, anything like that. Yeah. I did one of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood t-shirts.
Really?
You know, the one with the guy upside down in his, I've done it in like Houdini style.
Yeah.
Where he's trapped.
Yeah.
I did that. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, for
man.
Nick.
I had no idea that you were an artist. More of an artist than I am.
Well, I had a conversation when my daughter was younger, when she was about 8 years old, 7 or 8. She's 22 now. And I had a conversation because I was doing a lot of drawing, and she went, she had the idea that said, oh, you're right, blah, blah, blah. She said, but you're not a real artist. And I went, well, because I was, what was I doing? I think I was a gardener at the time.
Yeah.
And I've done many jobs. And she said, well, you're not a real artist. And I said, well, define a real artist. What is a real artist? And she said, well, someone that gets paid to do it. And I said, well.
That's not necessarily true.
But it's not true, is it?
No, it's not true.
I said, well, if I draw this, if someone pays me to do it, does that then qualify me as an artist? I said, if you're an artist isn't the expression of yourself.
Yeah? Yeah, it's like doing, if you do the same thing, but someone pays, like the identical thing.
Yeah.
Except someone pays for one of them and not for the other.
Yeah.
That can't make the two things different.
No.
So like, you may not be a professional artist.
Yeah, that's a complete.
It doesn't stop
you
from being an artist.
I tried to be.
Really?
Just before I kind of went full time with the jiu-jitsu, I had a cleaning business, like window cleaning and just cleaning stuff in general, mainly window cleaning. And that's what I was doing as a job. I'd done every job you can imagine, like while teaching jiu-jitsu and losing money in jiu-jitsu, you know, because you could never make any kind of money whatsoever when I first started.
Sure, yeah.
Because unless you run a karate club, there was no students. No one wanted to do it. And I was keeping my art going and going and going. And I was just like, this is rubbish. I'm not, you know, what am I going to do? Because I'm getting on in age. I mean, I think I was early 30s at the time. And I wanted to basically make it a career. So, you know, I did. I went up to the comic cons and I had interviews with DC and Marvel and people like
really?
That. Yeah, about doing it. And
you got to send me some of your art. I want to check it out. It'd be really interesting to see that. Yeah,
it's not a problem. Yeah, and I did stuff like that. And they loved my staff and they wanted me to kind of go back and do some more and stuff like that. And one company commissioned me to do like a few bits and bobs and stuff. But it was never published because it was only a big press, but a smaller press. And I think the guy had bigger ideas than his wallet could imagine. And sure, I don't think that it come into fruition, but you know, he was in films and he was kind of in that media. And I think at the time everything was just exploding in the comic book industry, like the first Iron Man films and all that were coming out. So everyone from different media, especially the film media, were trying to get on board with comics, get a big comic and then maybe make a film out of it and stuff like that. And I felt that's what he wanted to do. So, yeah, I did drawings for that, this, that, and the other, but nothing really came of it. And then, you know, obviously I kind of went to the jiu-jitsu side because I worked out basically, which is incredible, how much money at the beginning stages, a little bit like a fighter. People think you make a lot of money, but the amount of hours you have to spend and the graft to not making nearly any money at all. And to do a page, a comic book page, probably takes about 12 hours. And that's pretty quick if you want to do it to a good standard.
One page
probably takes about 12 hours straight sitting down. If you want to, and that's just the penciling without the inking.
Wow.
If you want to do it to a high standard, and you have to do it to a high standard if you want repeat
very
work.
Competitive.
Well, yeah, it's like an actor. If you're going to be an actor, then you might get one job and go, yes, I've made it. This is the role I've been after.
Yeah, you've got to smash it and get called back.
And then maybe the show is not that successful. Maybe the critics are not that nice about your work. No one phones after that.
Yeah.
It can be the same with comic. Well, it is the same with the comic book industry. I know because I spoke to a lot of the guys there. The guy that done V for Vendetta, I know him. I had a lot of, you know, he was like kind of a friend around that time, and he was giving me a lot of advice. He lives in Brighton. The guy who did all that work for that, Dave, his name is. And the thing is, if it's not high quality work, then the likelihood of you getting another job afterwards is going to be kind of, you know, a little bit shy. So it would take like minimum, I reckon, good quality work, 12 hours. And if you're lucky, you might get paid between £75-£100 per page.
Wow. That's not even minimum wage. No. Like when you work out the hours that you're actually spending.
And you think of the high standard and
it's pressure, right?
Well, it's pressure because
you got to turn in good work. You know, it's like, but like you find another job that's minimum wage, like you're flipping burgers at McDonald's. How much pressure is it? Are you really in that scenario?
But what's the skill set for that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but you take these guys, the skill set, and not everyone can, I believe it's kind of like elite level jiu-jitsu, man. Not many, there's only so many Hodges. Yeah. There's only so many Marcellos, and we can go down the list. There's only so many Dans.
Stop it, you're buttering me up already.
but no, but it's true though, isn't it? It's kind of,
you're always going to have like the one percentile of everything, you know, like the people who are working at the top of the comic book industry or the people at the top of any industry, doesn't matter how many people are in there, there's always going to be the one percentile elite.
Well, take the UFC. I know a few guys, a few friends of mine that have been there, been on the big stage and stuff like that. And I know guys have lost money. Like, it's cost them. Cost them money to be on the UFC.
Yeah, there were guys, there was one guy recently, I can't remember who it was, which is really irritating, but he said, like, I can't fight. Like, you're offering me fights. I can't fight because like, the amount of money it will take me to run this camp, I am not going to get my fees covered. I can't do this. I'm going to have to go and get a job.
Yeah, that's what's
to make enough money to run a camp, to fight, to hopefully rise up the ranks enough to be able to do this without having to worry about paying for camps.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And
which
everyone,
is crazy.
Yeah, and everyone thinks because you're like a big name in something that you make money.
Yeah.
Same within how many artists do you know that it's the classic story of he kind of died poor and could barely feed himself, and these are like the highest artists to ever live in the history of the world, and who died rich. It's crazy.
Do you think they can come down to like a combination of sort of, you have to balance your art, whether that's martial arts or literal art in this case, with kind of a business acumen as well? Like, you can be the greatest MMA fighter, but if you sign a shitty contract, if you fight 10, you come into the UFC and you're so excited to come into the UFC that you sign a 7-fight contract with £5,000 show money per fight, you may become UFC champion and you're still getting shat on.
Yeah, I mean, it's the hardest thing. I mean, we're in the same boat as in that sense of, you're doing this podcast, I've come here to do it with you. Why? For exposure.
Yeah.
And we got to do it ourselves. Mm. You didn't pay me to come here today?
No. Yeah.
It's out of my own pocket.
Yeah.
But this is what people don't think.
You did get free water though.
Mate, the water's nice. It's
M&S water. Ooh, I know, mate. I told you it was luxurious.
God.
You basically got paid with Scottish mountain water.
I know, it's the best. Only the best.
Only the best.
No, but this is what I think some people don't realise, is they look at guys in certain positions and, there's only a few guys that are kind of making the money. And even when they look at promotions, and I don't like naming names and I won't, but I know many promotions that they've lost a lot of money and where they should have made a lot of money, especially in BJJ. So all the guys out there, you got to support these bigger events.
This is like a really something that I've pushed so long, because I think that with it's this consumer mentality, know, with a big industry, people don't care about the corporations, they don't care about the brands, because in the mainstream the brands are multi-billion dollar international brands that can
Nike and Reebok,
exactly. You're not going to give a fuck about supporting Nike doesn't need. But then when and even with the UFC is nowadays, the UFC is a massive corporation that doesn't necessarily need the individual's real hard-earned support. But then when you go down to a smaller level, like you're talking about not just jiu-jitsu, which is so much small, you can't view British homegrown submission grappling shows in the same way that you would treat the UFC or Nike, where you as someone who wants to consume from things like Tough Invitational, or like Polaris, like all of these shows, Polaris is a big one because it's Polaris stood out as this show that's not doing, it's doing what no one has ever done before in the UK.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But like, people don't realize, like, absolutely, they're doing amazing. Obviously we both fought on Polaris, but they're doing something no one's ever done before because it's not possible to do.
And the way they treat the fighters well, I've got to say, is incredible.
I got treated better by Polaris than I did at EBI, like, to be straight with you. And EBI would be considered a much bigger show.
Worldwide, of course. I mean, they're on Fight Pass.
And stuff like that. But I got treated, and I'm not saying that the EBI treated me badly, but there was no personal connection with the athletes at Polaris. Obviously, I knew the guys anyway, but you go in there, they're all very warm, they're friendly, they're shaking hands, they're
first name terms.
They're giving you, all 16 fighters for EBI, apart from the Danaher guys, were in the same changing room.
Really?
I was literally brushing shoulders, bumping into the guy that I fought in my first fight whilst we were both warming up, which just isn't ideal. At Polaris, you split all of the fighters like you should do into two separate changing rooms. So I found Polaris was really sorting out the and we got like gift bags with t-shirts and rash guards and towels. And
I didn't get any of that.
You didn't get that?
I didn't get it.
Well, maybe they took it out for Polaris. You're on three, right? Or four?
Last one.
Yeah, four. You're on four. I was on two. So maybe they stopped doing that. But I got that. But with EBI, I didn't get fuck all. My my coach, Andy, he stole me a t-shirt, which you can't tell anyone from EBI, but he stole me he stole me a staff t-shirt. So I have one EBI t-shirt, which I got through.
I'm sure they'd be all right. I'm sure they'd live
through
it.
Sorry, Eddie. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'll give it back if you want it. So yeah, they do really do sort out, but like they need to be supported. And like, I almost don't want to sound like a broken record, but guys, like, like Polaris has a show coming up in August.
Yeah.
Which hopefully I will be fighting on. Spoiler. They have a show coming up in August, and this is like, people are moaning about, oh, it's in Cardiff, oh, and now it's all the way down in Poole, which probably worked really well for you, wasn't it?
Because in Poole, no, London worked much better. Poole's bloody miles away from me. Yeah. Oh, well, I've come from Hastings, yeah. So to make it to the O2, it take about an hour and a half, 20 minutes. So,
okay,
because that's where I parked today.
Yeah,
going to see the wrestling tonight.
Yeah, we're talking about that. You're going to SmackDown.
That's it. Yeah, I'm going to take some names.
There you go. But like to get submission grappling at, you know, at the O2 in London.
Yeah,
like people need to go and watch this live.
Yeah,
you know, it's absolutely not even about like. And everyone say, oh, I won't bother going watching it live. I'll buy it on stream. Like, go there. It's not going to be the same. You cannot guarantee like, oh, it's bad timing. I don't really want to go to this one. I'll go to the next one. There might not be a next one.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. To be honest,
there might not be a next one.
It's like anything. If no one supports your business,
yeah,
how long is your business going to be there?
Yeah.
And it's that typical thing of, yeah, well, I'll do the next one. And then it's not there. And everyone goes, oh, I would have. It's kind of like,
exactly.
You know, just get a bunch of your friends. I mean, it's in London. It's quite easy for everyone to get to. You know, get a bunch of your friends. Talk at your academy.
Yeah.
You know, just say, look, I'm going there. Anyone else want to come? And before you know it, the thing's going to be sold out.
Yeah.
They do it for UFC. This is what really drives me mad, right? You get guys, and I know guys that train, and UFC's in town. Everyone goes to the UFC.
Yeah.
And they're all jiu-jitsu guys. And then you get something like Polaris or TAF or one of these other shows that are trying to put jiu-jitsu on the big stage.
They don't support it in the same way, trying to make it professional.
Yeah. So the guys that do jiu-jitsu can hopefully at some point start the exposure that we're talking about.
Reaping the benefits of what pushing this sport and trying to push this sport higher and higher does.
Yeah, well, the more exposure, you know, you guys get and stuff like that, and me, myself, it's everything else comes in afterwards. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like the sponsorship from this, and the more, you know, more people start training, the bigger the whole things get, the bigger the academies get. And everyone benefits from it. But I find it really interesting that they go to like UFC and, you know, drop a ton of money on something like that. But then when that comes up, oh, I'm not sure. And they kind of want to do it, but it's, you know, and I don't know, it's really funny, I don't know why, but yeah, everyone, that if you're going to go to the UFC, don't go to the UFC.
Go to Polaris. Come on, guys, sort it out.
Do it.
And you can come and get drunk with me afterwards, I promise. Okay? And Paul. So that, we moved on, we got off on a tangent and then started ranting about Polaris. From comic book stuff. So look, I got, before we move on to actually talking about jiu-jitsu again.
Go on. Everything leads back to jiu-jitsu. This is the conversation.
No.
This is the conversation. We will go back to it, but this is the conversation I always have. My wife always says, no matter what the everyone out there is the same, but you're the same.
Yeah.
No matter what the subject is, it could be about anything. It always flows back to jiu-jitsu, or I find an analogy that actually relates straight to jiu-jitsu, and I start going on about jiu-jitsu again.
Would you like find it hard to talk to people who don't understand jiu-jitsu, because then you start busting out jiu-jitsu analogies, and you know, like, if you're talking to a group of jiu-jitsu guys, even if it was about something non-jiu-jitsu related, you would bust out a jiu-jitsu analogy and everyone would just be like, ah, yeah, I got you. So you're talking to someone who doesn't do jiu-jitsu and you're trying to bust this stuff out and you're like, oh, you guys aren't going to understand this.
Well, I don't know. My mum still thinks I do karate. I don't know. She does. She goes, you're still doing karate? I'm like, mum, I've not done karate in like 20 odd years. She still thinks I do it. Which I'm like, come on, you know. I can talk about jiu-jitsu at any point, any given. But I'm pretty good as far as, you know, if I'm talking to the general populace that doesn't do jiu-jitsu.
I call them civilians.
Yeah. They don't understand.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, back last time with the comics. What's your favourite comic? Like, what's your favourite? Like, or is it...
To read?
Is that like asking a jiu-jitsu guy what his favourite submission is?
A little bit. Obviously, my favourite superhero is quite obvious. It just stems from when I'm young, Superman. That's my favourite.
Okay.
Just because when I grew up on Superman, so he's got that little place in my heart from when I was tiny yeah. boy. I used to have Superman wallpaper and bed sheets and all that stuff. So yeah, but to read, probably Hellboy to read.
Yeah,
It's funny. Yeah, it's funny, quite dark.
So like
a good sense of humor.
I consider myself like probably the kind of person that you would hate as a lifetime comic book fan, which is like I've not read almost any comic books, but I consider myself like I like the story. Like I watch the films. I like the films, but yeah. I kind of like I explore the story behind it. Like research what's going on, but yeah. without reading the comic books, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, but you don't have to read the comics to be a fan of the genre.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, sure. So that's kind of where I classify myself. But if I had to read it, if you told me like Dan, first comic book, proper comic book, what would you advise me to read as a comic book, a guy who's got so close into the industry, he almost worked for it. What would you tell me to go read?
Well, you like a laugh, pretty good sense of humor.
Yeah,
I think. Looking at your ape poster over there, it's quite dark, a lot of red. Go Hellboy.
Yeah.
Hellboy, yeah, cool, yeah. Man. Yeah, if you don't like that, I'll be surprised.
Is there any issue
Deadpool's quite good. He's quite funny.
Yeah.
But I just start at the beginning. Yeah? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but Hellboy's quite good.
Okay,
yeah.
I might buy that.
Yeah.
I'm going to check that out. Okay, so let's move on. Let's move on to your jiu-jitsu. Here
you go.
So let's go way back. What's the first martial art that you did?
Judo.
Okay.
Believe it or not.
Believe
we'll
it
come
or not.
Back to my last fight. I wish I'd have continued. Yeah, 33 years in the making that was coming, that throw, I tell you.
Okay, so you start with just judo. What age were you when you were doing judo?
9. Yeah, no, I started, I didn't want to do it. The only reason I was forced into it by my mum and dad, kind of forced into it, as much as I could be, because my brother, went to Eastleigh Community School in East London, and I was still in primary, and every Thursday, they used to go to Tesco's, and they wanted to go to Tesco's, but they didn't want me going around Tesco's with them hassling for Star Wars figures or anything like that. So they used to drop me off and said, well, seeing as, you know, your brother Dean's going to judo and he loved it, you can go and do it. I hated it.
Really?
Couldn't stand it. Yeah. All it was, guys throwing me and pinning me. Can you believe that? How ironic is that?
Yeah.
And I didn't really like it. I did it for a little bit. Kind of cause I was pushed into it like some kids are.
So you were 9 years old.
Yeah.
So let's just whip it back to your,
it's a long while.
It's the same age as almost the same age as your son at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Neo is 8.
Does he do any martial arts?
Jiu-jitsu, yeah.
Yeah. Does he hate being pinned as much as you hated being pinned?
Nah, he's so competitive. He's going to be worse than me.
What do you think they're different? Like, what was it, if you can think back to the psychology of yourself as a 9-year-old, but what is the sort of thing that makes a kid not, like, really hate the experience of grappling compared to another kid who loves the experience of grappling?
I just hated the pinning aspect, not being
just
able to
helplessness.
Move. Yeah, it's kind of, it just annoyed me that I didn't mind the throwing so much as I can remember, because it's a while ago now, but it was just getting pinned and not being able to move, and I thought it was a bit pointless.
Yeah.
I was like, well, you're just pinning me, get off me.
Yeah,
you're just pinning me.
Yeah.
What's the point in that? I didn't understand what the point of just pinning someone was. I wanted to move and do stuff, and you know,
that leads quite nicely into jiu-jitsu, doesn't it?
Yeah. And maybe why I connected, I don't know. I know why I connected with jiu-jitsu, but maybe that was the missing link. Maybe if it was jiu-jitsu, I would have carried on. I don't know, because it was kind of, I didn't really get it. I understood that it was like a martial art, you know, wearing these white pyjamas, whatever, you know, but someone throwing me and then just pinning me. And a lot of them in the club, because I think they were all kind of in their teenage years and older, were a lot bigger than me as well. So
it's frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big guy now. So, I mean, back then I was tiny, you know. I like my son. He's going to be about 6'4".
Oh, really?
He's big, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because my other son, Lewis, he's over 6'4".
Oh, wow.
Tall.
Yeah. How many kids you got together?
3.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got a daughter, 22, Maria, son, Lewis, just turned 21, and Neo, who's 8. Yeah,
okay.
And he's the most competitive kid I've ever known in my life.
Did you, just out of interest, did you, because my friend, Andy, actually, who's training downstairs at the moment, he runs a podcast. This is a subtle plug for his podcast. He runs a podcast called The Mighty Dad Podcast, which is kind of like his. That's kind of
that was seamless thing. The way you slipped it in there.
It is impressive. Beautiful. Had I not actually mentioned the fact that I was slipping in, no one would have noticed. But I was listening. I've been listening to it, and obviously, like, he used to do jiu-jitsu. He's a blue belt, but he does a lot of work, strength conditioning work with jiu-jitsu guys. Mm-hmm. And he's been on, he was episode one on the podcast, but he's got three kids, so like he's big into kind of the whole fatherhood thing, and he runs a podcast talking to other dads about that. And I find that listening to that now makes me think when like it's switching my head on to all of that stuff. So like, does your other kids, your elder kids, did you get them into martial arts at all? Or?
Yeah, they all did jiu-jitsu when they were younger. Then none of them really did it the way Neo does it. They kind of did it, they did enough of it that it's like Maria, she's done enough of it that if there's a problem, she can kind of handle it.
Which is like really, you know, all you really want as a parent, isn't
it? Yeah, that's all you need, because it's the same as everyone says to me, like, because like Neo's with me all the time, does all the classes, stuff like that, because obviously I pick him up, drop him off, blah, blah, blah. He's there with me all the time. And it's one of them things, it's kind of, everyone's like, oh man, like when he gets older, he's going to do this. And I said, look, he's going to do whatever he wants to do. I said, if he wants to be a dancer, a painter, if he wants to be a vet, if he wants to be a builder, that's up to him. You know what I mean? But
he's going to be able to defend himself though.
Yeah. All I can say is I'll give him a vehicle that he can kind of use if he hopefully wants to.
Yeah.
Because for me, it was always a game of playing catch up. I mean, because I didn't start till I was in my 20s. So, you know, it's kind of, and then you got all the Brazilians coming over that have been doing it
since
I was five.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's like, Jesus Christ, this is a different level. Mm. And that's what he's going to be. You know what I mean? It'd be the same thing. He's known it. He doesn't know any different.
Yeah.
He's been doing it. But he's a pain in my backside to teach.
Really?
Well,
it must be so difficult to teach your own kids.
Oh, yeah.
They just don't respect you like a teacher because you're just dad. And
I just thought it was me. Then I spoke to Hodger about it. I even spoke to Hoyce about it. And they said the same thing. I went,
They always send their kids to another instructor.
Yeah.
Same thing I had with Simon Hayes, whose kid Billy, who's doing really well at the moment. He says he doesn't teach him. He has the kids instructors at Carlson's teaching.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think that's a really, really standard thing that, and it's kind of funny, like you can imagine Roger Gracie's kid who's going to learn jiu-jitsu from not Roger Gracie. You know, obviously Roger's going to be there to help him and mentoring him and stuff like that. But it's just going to be, it's so difficult to teach your kid because there's just that dynamic is not the correct coach, instructor.
No, it just
dynamic.
Drives you mad because he sees me obviously as dad.
Yeah.
And, there's only one kid that plays up in my class.
Yeah, of course. And that's the thing, like you're not just a guy teaching jiu-jitsu to him on the mat, everyone. Mm. Like he's in your classes, right?
Yeah.
That's just ridiculous. That must be impossible.
Yeah, it's hard work because he drives me mad because all the rest of the kids are great, this, that, and I just find myself going, Neo, no, stop, right, stop doing it. No, right, come here. Right, let's have a chat. Why are we doing, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's kind of like, and it just... And I always say to him, look, I shouldn't be standing here kind of telling you what not to do.
Stop embarrassing me in front of the rest of the kids.
Because then I've got to help everyone. Or he wants me just to go with him. And I'm like, I can't because I've got to help everyone else.
Yeah.
And my time has to be, I've got other coaches as well, but my time has to be split, you know. Otherwise, you know, parents watching it and be like, well, he only helps his own child. And, you know, and I've got all the time in the world to do that, you know.
Yeah, well, like you almost have to, when there's any possible favoritism in any sense, you've got to go in the opposite direction. Like you can't even be neutral.
I'm actually harder on him than the other kids.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So like, for example, when at Kleos, the tournament that I run, when I'm reffing and like, ideally you're not going to ref your own students, but I ref all day and there are a lot of my students there. Yeah. I'm going to ref one or two of my students. I am twice as hard on them as I am on anyone else, you know, because if someone get on, the last thing you want to do is be that guy who sorted out his student, you know.
We've all seen it go on.
It happens all the time. Yeah. And it's happened to me on multiple occasions and it's infuriating.
Yeah.
So like if there's a ref decision, like you better hope that you're not my student. And I'll tell you like, I'm sorry, mate. I can't give it to you. I've got to give it, you know, like that. And
oh, really? Even if you believe he deserves it?
I just... if it's 50-50, I'm going to give it the other way, just because, you know,
everyone's going
to
be like,
because you have to yeah. And you know what, I remember in one case I was reffing one of my guys in a Nogi competition, and he was winning the fight. He was up on points. He was stalling, or what I considered stalling. He was up on points, 2 points up, and he was inside the closed guard of the opponent. He wasn't doing anything to try and pass the guard.
Yeah.
Now, there was like a minute, maybe 30 seconds left in the match. And with anyone else, I wouldn't have said anything. With him, I'm going, Alan, you got to move. You got to do something on top. You've got to do like way more than I would even think about doing that with anyone else.
Yeah.
So he goes the move, ends up getting triangled.
And then you feel like a bad guy. Yeah,
but I'm like, you know what? So it must be the same. Like, because you've got these eyes on you, like you can't show favoritism. You've almost got to go the opposite way. You've got to be more harsh on him.
Yeah.
You've got to show more attention to the other kids.
Yeah.
It's an awkward sort of situation.
It's very difficult. And that's why I really understand with people, you know, that. Some of the guys I've spoken to about it, like any Gracie that I've spoken to about it, because they've grown up in it, and you'd expect them to teach, and they go, no way, man, I don't teach my kid, are you crazy?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh really? And it's like, no, I'll get someone else to do it. And it's like, yeah, but for me, there was no one else to do it, you know what I mean? Until now I've got coaches coming through, like kids coaches and stuff, so I can kind of push him towards
sit
them a little
back
bit more
from that coach role and sit into the father role.
Yeah.
So let's go back to you. Yeah. You're at this point, you're 9 years old, you're doing judo.
Yep.
Where did that progress from there? You were doing judo because your mum didn't want to bother going shopping with you because you're a pain in the ass in Tesco's.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, asking for toys and stuff. Yeah. What kids at that age do. So nowhere really. I did it for a while, and then I don't know, just fizzled out, and I think my brother probably stopped doing it, so I was like, yep, great, I'll stop doing it as well. Never went anywhere. Then the Karate Kid hit,
and it was on.
That was it.
Yeah,
it was karate all the way from now,
because that did blow up the sport, didn't it?
I was obsessed with karate. I was just like, wow, I've got to learn karate. And the main reason being is because, I mean, I grew up, obviously, in East London, and the school that I went to wasn't the best.
Yeah.
It really wasn't for, like, trouble and everything. It was not a great, outstanding school by any measure. And I heard, like, went to, it's when I went, I think it was first year of seniors, the secondary school, and I heard that one of the older kids, who's like a couple of years older, but at that age, you think a couple of years is like a full grown man, that he wanted to like stab me.
Okay.
So I was like, and he was, you know, Chicken George was his name. And
okay.
He was like bad news. He was really bad news as well.
This was the Johnny character to your Daniel son.
Yeah, but Johnny didn't stab people. So I heard. I don't know. Nothing ever come from it.
Okay.
Nothing ever did.
Good.
But I used to have to, like, on break, used to have to walk through like a park, and always knew that he, you know, was in that park. And yeah, I'd heard he beaten up a few people quite badly, like really badly. And so I was like, right, so I'm going to need to defend myself.
Yeah.
The only thing to defend myself and where I'm going to be able to kick real ass is karate.
Yeah.
So, I found a local school. It's Beckton Judo Club at the time. I went there with, Hayashi Karate or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just started doing karate. Did that for quite a few years, and then reading magazines, someone said, oh, there's another school called like Tang Sudo, it's what Chuck Norris does and all that. And because my club moved from where were they doing? They was doing it in Plasto, near Kenyon Town. They moved all the way over to Beckton. Mm-hmm. And it was quite, I was only young and I had to get a bus, and it was quite hard to do that at that age. So this one was only up the road in Newham Sports Centre.
So I thought, oh, I'll go and do that. So, and read about Tang Soo, it was Chuck Norris's art. So I was like, man, if it's good enough to Chuck, it's good enough for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, you can't complain. So I started doing that. I did that for years and years and years and went all the way up to my brown belt in that. I was probably 17, 18 at the time. And then went over with another club and started doing like freestyle karate. Did that for a while.
Did you ever have a confrontation with, what was his name? Chicken
George? No, never.
Chicken George was his
Chicken
name.
Chicken George, yeah.
That's an awesome name, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
You never came to blows with Chicken George?
No, never.
Once you found out you were a brown belt in the Chuck Norris martial art?
I think maybe it was just my people winding
just
me up.
Shitting you up.
Yeah, yeah.
He was like Kaiser Soze.
Yeah.
Did he not? He didn't even exist.
No, he did. Just, I know. Yeah, I know, really? I know who the guy is, okay. Yeah. Yeah, nothing ever come from it.
That sounds like the stupid shit that kids would tell you to shit someone up. Just like, oh yeah, yeah. Chicken George said that he was going to stab you. You're like, fuck.
But if I'd never done it, I'd never been here with you.
There you go, man.
See,
every destiny,
every rainbow.
Absolutely, 100%. So you're a brown belt in Tang Soo Do.
Yep. And then I started doing freestyle karate. Offshooted from
you've really done a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I did boxing. Did some Thai boxing. All bits and bobs. Then I done freestyle karate, got black belt under Alfie Lewis, who's like a legend in like freestyle karate. Like back in the day, that was 1995, I got my black belt in that. Yeah. And we started teaching in Dagenham, the freestyle karate stuff. And where we wanted to kind of mix it up and make it, you know, bit like kickboxing, bit like freestyle karate, you know, like kind of just mixing it. Like people will mix grappling or MMA nowadays.
It's like loads of martial arts used to kind of like cross train before it was called MMA. Like it is MMA. It's mixed martial arts. Like it's just that nowadays MMA is considered a very specific mix of martial arts.
Yeah.
But like essentially back in the day before it had a name called MMA, it was called cross training. You'd cross train karate and boxing, or you cross train Thai boxing and wrestling or whatever.
Yeah, and then just brawling because no one had a Danny LaRue what was going on.
Yeah.
And then from that, I mean, that's where all the jiu-jitsu started. Because I was in a club with a good friend of mine who became my brother-in-law, which was Jeff. He owned like just a little studio, and out the back they had like it was used to be a dance studio, but he used to mat it, and that's where we started like doing a lot of the freestyle karate. And because it was freestyle, we could add stuff to it. And then one of my friends brought tape in of UFC 2, like back in the day, VHS, not even DVD. Yeah, to watch
there
it.
There are kids watching this, listen to this guy. What is a VHS?
Yeah. Yeah, it's very.
Is that like a flash drive?
it's like a thing with a tape in it. Yeah. And that's where it all started from. One of my friends brought in UFC 2, and like everyone else, I watched it and was like, "Oh, who's this guy?
Who's this guy? Why is he just beating everyone?"
And couldn't understand what he was doing at all on his back. His legs, and it seemed that he wanted people on top of him and then strangling people. And it was just like this magic that no one else understood. It was crazy.
It was such a, like, the collective traditional martial art world all had that exact same, the simultaneous feeling, like, what is this witchcraft?
Yeah. Well, there was two types of people. I mean, I'm happy that I was... The one that I fell into was,
which was,
I was fascinated.
Yeah, and the other people denied it and ran away from it.
Yeah, I was absolutely fascinated because not being a big guy, because and what sealed it for me more was because we saw it, didn't watch any instructional DVDs to start off with or anything. We just saw what we saw
and started trying to do it.
And let's add a little bit of wrestling. And one guy was like, "Yeah, I know a little bit of judo." Another guy was like, "Yeah, I know a little bit of this." So we go through the stand-up portion. We start with the kicking, the punching. And as soon as we get like any kind of clinch, let's try and go for a throw and do some stuff on the ground. But what I noticed very quickly was all I seemed to do is get headlocked, pinned, and I'd have to tap through pain of being in a really crappy position because I'm not a big guy. So
do you have flashbacks to judo class?
Yeah, and this is rubbish.
Yeah,
but then
not this shit all over again.
but then I mean, what was really lucky for me was a friend of mine from Tang Soo Mark Walder, come and started training with us. And we both of us are no big guys at all. So we kind of had the conversation and went, this is crap. We've actually got to do something for real. We got to actually learn what we're doing. No one has a clue.
Mark hadn't done any jiu-jitsu at that point.
No.
So for those who don't know who Mark is, for those who are newer to the game, Mark is one of the first three black belts under Mauricio Gomez. They say the first three homegrown British-born black belts, which is Jude Samuels, Mark Warder, and Rick Young. So when Paul is casually referring to Mark Warder in this, he's a pretty significant figure in the history of jiu-jitsu.
Continue. Yeah, and then we had the conversation of, you know, this is rubbish because it always seems to do me get headlocked by Jeff, thrown on the floor, and squeezed. And the bigger guys were kind of having their way, kind of, because if you don't know anything, the man who kind of knows a little bit and outweighs you and is stronger is going to win.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
So that's what we found. And then Mark said, oh, yeah, we got them. So we started training together a little bit, and then he ordered, like, the... was it Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Basics from Torrance?
Yeah.
And he got them on VHS, brought them over. And then he said, look, I've got these. Do you want to start, like, kind of going over some stuff? So I used to go round his house in his front room on the carpet. And we just started practicing, like, just basics, like triangle, an armbar from guard, mount control, stuff like that. And it was absolutely fascinating.
Wow.
When we went back to the mat, how much just off the back of them tapes we'd jumped.
Wow.
For like just that little bit of knowledge. I mean, and you know that, don't you? Mm-hmm. When you see a white belt who's been doing it 2 months, someone comes in, doesn't know anything.
Yeah.
And if they're dedicated and they've paid attention, it's incredible.
That's what I say to people, like people, they think generally, like, and obviously there are exceptions, but as a general rule, when you come in as a beginner, like the people that are started ahead of you will always be ahead of you. For the most part, there's going to be a little fluctuation, but for the most part, when you're a beginner and everyone else is advanced, you're not going to catch up with them, assuming that they're training the same amount that you are.
Yeah.
But what happens is it's like a totem pole. You're at the bottom until someone comes in at the bottom.
Yeah.
And then you realize, like, oh, I'm not the beginner anymore.
I've got some
there's
skills.
Someone below me. And now he's looking at me like I'm advanced.
Yeah.
You know, that's what, so like beginners who are really like, oh, for fuck, everyone keeps beating me up. Just wait till the new guy comes in. And suddenly he's confused and actually you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's where the big change happens.
Yeah. I mean, that was back in 1995.
Wow.
As well. So,
holy shit.
Yeah, and we started doing that. And it's like, I don't know, I've always said to people that I don't know where the history books start on BJJ in this country, but I don't know anyone. I don't know. And if anyone does know out there to correct me, I'm wrong. But I don't know anyone that was doing it at the point that me and Mark were doing it. Because soon after that, we actually wanted to do more of the jiu-jitsu. So we rented out, because it's really hard as well. Because I went to Newham, because we wanted to teach it, like the jiu-jitsu. Without all the bleeding side of the karate, we just wanted, let's just teach like the jiu-jitsu as the jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And we called it like freestyle jiu-jitsu because, you know, I don't think we really knew enough to call it like Gracie jiu-jitsu or this, that, and kind of claim anything that we wasn't. So
this was back in 95?
Yeah, and I went to Newham Leisure Centre.
That is early, man.
Yeah, I went to Newham Leisure Centre to try to book a spot, like just on, then they had space. And I went in there and said to them, is it all right if we book like a space to do, like to teach martial arts? Oh, well, what is it you do? Oh, jiu-jitsu. It's like Gracie jiu-jitsu. It's like, well, what is that? Well, it's from Brazil. It's like a style of jiu-jitsu. It's like self-defense, this, that, and the other. And they were just like, oh, okay. Well, we've got to speak to our karate instructor to kind of make sure that what you're saying
doesn't clash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it, has it got, you know, like,
association or anything?
Yeah. And I said, no, not really. I said, because it's quite new and stuff like that, and it's like in Brazil, and like it's from America as well.
You don't want to tell them that you just learned it from a DVD
or
a VHS?
No, because we had guys that wanted to do it. They wanted to kind of do it with us, should I say. And because I had a black belt already, I was just saying it was freestyle.
Yeah.
So that's how we were spinning it, that it was a freestyle jiu-jitsu, not associated, because no one was doing it. But we tried to go in there. And what made me laugh is they said, we'll come back next week. And I went back there and they said, no, our karate instructor doesn't recognize jiu-jitsu, blah, blah, blah. I was like,
well, we ain't doing karate.
But that's what I said to them. I said, but it's not karate.
Yeah.
But that was the thing back in the day.
That's your football team doesn't recognize rugby. Well, yeah. It's different sports. Like, yeah. Why is it even a question?
Yeah, and it drove me mad. And we couldn't get in anywhere. Because everywhere we went, you had these
they always
different...
had one martial arts school who didn't want another martial arts school.
Yeah, they were like, no, don't recognize it. Whether they knew kind of what it was and didn't want it encroaching on...
Like they'd heard about UFC 1.
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah, yeah, maybe.
They heard jiu-jitsu. You should have called it something else. You could have called it something shit. You should have called it kung fu or something like that. That like, oh, that kung fu is bollocks. Freestyle kung fu. Oh, yeah. Let the guys have the mat space. That's cool.
Yeah. No, yeah, they've got no kind of...
But it makes sense that those guys would be shit in their pants about jiu-jitsu because they just seen it. They just seen proof. This was what UFC 1 did. Yeah. This was proof that this is the great... This is the best single martial art.
Mm-hmm.
When you start combining them, it changes. But this is the best single martial art that you can do in a no rules fight.
Yeah, I always say it to everyone when they go, oh, well, jiu-jitsu isn't as dominant as it used to be. No, all the guys
are
black belts.
They know jiu-jitsu.
All the guys are black belts.
They know jiu-jitsu.
But my argument for that is if you could wipe the slate clean, you only could do what, not MMA, just one of the martial arts that makes up MMA.
Yeah.
And you had one to pick to go in there, you could only train one of the disciplines.
Yeah.
What are you going to pick?
Well, you're asking a guy who does what who did no, that. But
seriously, even nowadays, if you could only, let's say we could wipe the whole history clean and say we're going to start this no old bard event, right?
Oh, you're going to go for MMA? Are you going to go for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu?
Of course,
obviously,
yeah, of course.
But you've seen it proven.
Yeah.
So this is like a really hard thing for a lot of people to take. Imagine you invest your entire life, possibly even your career, is teaching Jiu-Jitsu, and then an event has just happened that showed that this is not what you thought it was.
Yeah, or how easy it is to manipulate and overcome all the techniques that you thought were solid.
And then some guy comes ask you, you know, oh, there's these people that are claiming to do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. You're like, oh, I've heard of that shit.
Yeah.
Not where I am.
Yeah.
You know, not in my house.
And the only reason we could get into one, there was a sports centre in Dagenham.
Yeah.
The only reason we could get into there is because Mark had a friend who worked, one of the guys trained there called Danny, and he knew the guy, and he said, "And but we just rented the space in there." But it's the only reason we could get in there, that one, was because he knew someone that obviously worked there, so we could rent the space in there. Yeah, and we did that for a while. We just kind of had classes, you know, small classes, just the friends and stuff like that. And we both taught it for a little bit, like what we knew, and all we knew what was on, you know, the basics DVDs, because that's all. They didn't even have the intermediate. We had to wait for them. They didn't even have the intermediate DVDs, VHS tapes out then.
Yeah.
It was the first set they ever had. So we were just kind of, just rotating.
Yeah,
what was on them basically, and going through them, which was making our basics pretty good, because that's all we was going over. We wasn't going over anything else. And did that for a while, but then I was living in Wanstead at the time, because my mum and dad moved down to Ryan, East Sussex. But then I realised I didn't have any money, could barely eat this, that, and the other. And they said, "Well, come down." So I ended up moving down to Hastings area, which is Rye, which is just outside of Hastings. Yeah,
and then you've been there ever since.
Yeah, and I started teaching the same thing there. Because
so Mark stayed in London.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I stayed there for a while, and I started teaching freestyle jiu-jitsu at a local leisure centre.
What year was this?
That would have been 95 to 96.
Okay.
Yeah.
Still there, yeah.
And then a little while later, God, I can't remember what, same 97, 98. 98, I think. Yeah, about 98. And I still kept in contact with Mark.
Yeah.
And then one day he phoned me up and said, because I knew that he was, because he said that he was going to the Gracie Academy in America. And then obviously he went there for quite a while. He went there for 18 months, like every day. Yeah, every day. He was sponsored by one of his friends over there that he met when he went on one of the trips.
Yeah.
Because he went there, came back, And I was going up now and again and training with him still because we were still really good friends. And yeah, the jump that he made just within a couple of weeks
must have been ridiculous.
It was like he was a different person.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my God. Where we were kind of equal before a little bit,
suddenly
like,
I'd catch him, up, yeah.
He'd catch me. All of a sudden, he was strangling me with stuff that I was just like, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, and
that was
and,
about to come out in the intermediate DVD. Yeah,
and you know, and obviously Mark being a great guy, he was happy enough to share with me what he was learning and stuff like that. And he said I might be going away at some point soon because I've got like some sponsorship by one of the guys out there. He said I've just got to sort some details out that I might be going there for like quite a while, maybe a few months, maybe longer. Wow. to be an instructor.
Wow.
Yeah, he ended up going for 18 months solid, like I think 6 days a week, 8 a.m. to like 8, 9 p.m, just teaching. Very wow. strict program. The like Horian and Elio and people like then Hoyes and stuff like that. And then obviously I was still living down south on the coast. And then like a year, 18 months, whatever later, yeah, phone went and I was like, he's like, all right, Paul. And I'm like, who's this? And he's like, oh, you forget me already. I'm
like, he have a Brazilian accent at that point.
Yeah. One of them.
Hey Paula. Who the hell is this? It's me, a Mark.
Mark Awarda.
Paula.
Be like Mario. Yeah. And he's like, oh man, I've just come back from America and I'm thinking of starting up an official Gracie Academy. Gym in Dagenham and stuff like that. And all right, okay. He said, oh, well, you want to come down and do some training? I've got some really cool stuff. And he just gave me the breakdown of what he'd been doing, which sounded quite, you know, you have to be tough to get through that from nothing to be going to that kind of program every day is quite hard. And I was kind of inspired by how much he did. And I wanted to kind of do my own thing. And then, I can't remember if it was before or after. In 1998, I went and to California, but that was after I saw Choke.
Yeah.
So I went to Hickson's to do that because I was like, if there's one guy you got to learn under, this is the guy. So I went to that original place that you see in Pico Boulevard. One where he's on a mountain bike and he goes down the side alley. Yeah, I mean...
So you were out there training with Hickson?
Well, I've done most of my training under a guy called Mauricio Costa. Who's he was one of his brown belts at the time. Small guy as well. Very technical.
Yeah.
Very good. Met Hickson. Well, meeting Hickson?
After watching Choke.
He's just a super cool guy.
Yeah.
He's really, really cool.
But, like, it must be so weird because... you watch like a film of someone and like Choke is essentially the story of a god, you know, as much as you can get within jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And if you had to say that one human being in Brazilian jiu-jitsu that is a god, it's Hickson Gracie.
Yeah.
And it was like that Choke DVD was just basically about that. It was about like, this guy is the greatest ever. What's it like watching that, then flying out there and shaking the man's hand?
Well, the first night I got there, I got off the plane and didn't know where I was. I was in LA, got a taxi, knew kind of, because like this is in the days before Google or anything like that. It's like you're dropped off and that's it. You weren't
getting an Uber.
No, you weren't getting anything like that. Yeah. But you couldn't really work out where anything was. There was no Google Maps. There was nothing like that. So got off the plane, got in the cab. The only address I had was the address of the it was one in Pacific Palisades. So I got a cab, went there, cost an absolute fortune. I didn't realize how far it was. I was like, oh my god, hoping I had enough money, because all I was watching was the money going up and up. Thinking, god, I ain't got much money in my wallet here. And and paid for that, and they dropped me off. I didn't know where it was. It kind of looked like a business area, you know, like with the buildings and the business, and because Pacific Palisades is quite a rich area. And I'm standing there, big, massive suitcase, backpack, you know what it's like. And then I can see, and I think it's like Hickson walking like with his family and his kids. And then one of the kids in the skateboard comes up on a skateboard like that and goes, hey, here's Studio Jiu-Jitsu. You must have been like 6, 7, 8, something like really? That. Yeah, he had to do the jiu-jitsu. I was like, oh, yeah, he went, oh, follow me. Like that, he got on his skateboard, and his Kron. He's got on the skateboard. No. Yeah, he's going, no. So I followed him, obviously before Kron was Kron, as everyone wow. knows him now. He was a kid, like, yeah. like Neo is or something like that, you know. Yeah, so I followed him in and got signed up and met Hickson, met his wife and all that stuff. And, yeah, it's kind of a bit in awe, a bit too much to take in.
Sure.
And, you know, it's like when you travel and you after a long trip and it's yeah. kind of everything's coming out.
It's all a bit surreal, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, a little bit. Yeah, but did a lot of training now. I mean, I was training all the time. One of my biggest kick in my testicles was, I think I was going back on the Thursday and I was at the one in Pacific Palisades with Hickson and stuff like that. But a lot of the training I did with Mauricio.
Gomez?
No, Costa. One of his brown belts at the time. And he said, like, I was chatting with Hicks and he said, oh, man, he said, you here this weekend, like that. And I went, no. And he said, oh, man, he said, want to give you your blue belt this weekend. And I was like, oh, like under Hickson as well. Because yeah. I've been there for quite, you know, for a while. We're to that point where you're training so much. I had, like, blood on my elbows inside my gi and all that. Wow. 'Cause I was on the mat all the time. And because I just wanted, because I wasn't there, I was there for a while, but not in my eyes long enough. So I wanted to get as much mat time in as possible. Yeah. And yeah, they said, oh, he went, oh man, we're having grading this Saturday. You can't be here, no? And I'm like, no, I'm supposed to get on the plane. Yeah. They're like, oh, you know, can you? And I was like, can't do it. And I was yeah. like, it's such a kick. In,
fuck.
Yeah. But I mean, when I was out there, I competed and stuff like that. My first match I went to.
They never gave you a blue belt.
No, I mean, I was matched up against this. I was a white belt at the yeah. time, and obviously, and I was matched up against my first match I had was this kid, like quite tough looking, like quite well built.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he just picked me up, bang, threw me down on the ground, pinned me. I got him in a half guard, and like we messed about, but I pulled him back inside my guard, and he just pinned me on top, but got the points for the takedown, and didn't really do much, but I couldn't move. And it's like just holding me with like pure strength. And afterwards, I was kind of, you know, a bit disappointed because I wanted to kind of try and get in the medals and yeah. stuff. And his dad afterwards come over and went, hey, buddy, when don't worry about that. When he's like all American wrestling champion. I was yeah. great. First match I have ever yeah. in Brazilian jiu-jitsu competition. I pull out that card. Yeah.
yeah.
So, yeah, I just got dominated pretty much on that sense. But I was happy. I, you know, couldn't get out of my guard. But then again, I couldn't get him off the top of my head. You know what I mean? So, yeah, but that's a good experience. So, yeah, nearly 20 years I've been competing in jiu-jitsu.
Wow.
Which is, but that was my first proper jiu-jitsu competition.
So then you come back to the UK,
mm-hmm.
essentially a four-stroke white belt under Hicks and Gracie.
Yeah.
Just 2 days off of your blue belt.
Yeah.
They should have just given you the goddamn blue belt.
I know, it's so annoying.
What the fuck?
It's so annoying.
Where did it go from there? When did you, you know, who was your first instructor and how did you...
Well, I mean, a first instructor, I suppose, in jiu-jitsu is me and Mark.
Yeah, like, well I mean, other. Like, so who did you get your blue belt from?
Or VHS.
Yeah.
This is the first instructor.
This is like when a lot of people these days, their first instructor is YouTube.
Yeah.
Back, you know, a couple of years ago, it was DVDs.
Yeah.
And back in your day, it was VHS. Yeah.
Sensei
VHS.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, like, how did your path cross? Because I assume that your path crossed with sort of... You were doing jiu-jitsu in the UK before there was jiu-jitsu in the UK.
Yeah, because you know? Most people say about, well, how did it really start? And I said, well, when I came back from America, I started teaching, but I put a white belt on.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I'm not a black belt.
Yeah,
You know what I mean? I can't be teaching. I want to teach jiu-jitsu, but I'm not going to turn around to people and say I'm a black belt when I'm not.
Yeah.
So I put a white belt on and talked, and believe it or not, I got students, which I was shocked.
Yeah.
And, but it was the guys that I was teaching before, and I explained to them and they all carried on doing it. So I was, you know, I was surprised that I had the students in that sense and teaching it and people still signed up. Maybe it's because they come and tried it and saw, man.
They realised, yeah. Maybe they just wanted to do that thing from UFC, right?
Yeah, 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 like, maybe. So, I mean, I was teaching as a white belt. And people look at me now and go, huh?
Yeah.
What?
But, yeah, but it was a different time, guys. It was a different time.
There was nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, and that was the thing. And I thought to myself, like, I'm only a white belt teaching, but the thing is, where I was doing it, it was either the choice of either teach and, you know, and train, basically, because the teaching gave me possibility to train and get better. Yeah. And that was all it was.
You can't
about.
Train without any people.
No. So to have to train, I had to teach it.
Yeah.
To make sure that I was going through the techniques. It was either that or sign up to the local karate gym.
Yeah.
And that was it. So I'd have to do karate. And that's what it was. Basically, that was the choice. Is if I wanted to continue doing martial arts, which I did, I would have to do karate or
teach jiu-jitsu
with a white belt on. And so I did that, and it was a slow progression. And then from there, Mark came back, started to go up to Dagenham week in, week out, train.
So
with
I
him.
Assume Mark got his blue belt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whilst he was out there.
Yeah. So yeah. In that respect, he became my instructor, sure, because he knew more than me. He was further down the line. He's higher ranked than me. So he started teaching me like what he knew to up my game of very limited, you know, I'd learned stuff from Hicks and stuff like that. But it's, you know, a couple of months doesn't equate to 18 months of course, inside an academy every day. Yeah. So his knowledge was like, you know, well up on my knowledge. And I started doing it with him. He'd bring Hoyce came over, got my blue belt from Hoyce. Went all the way up with Mark under Hoyce to purple belt, got my purple belt off of Hoyce, and then Mauricio was in town at that time. He started coming over,
yeah,
and then for Mark's own progression, because being so far away from any kind of source of knowledge for where he could better his progression, he started to go over Mauricio when he'd come down to London and started training with him. And then we had the conversation. He said, look, I'm thinking of going over to Gracie Baja because, you know, I spoke to Hoyce about it. Hoyce is really cool about it. And he said, like, I feel I need to progress my jiu-jitsu. And Mauricio was helping him do that immensely. So he said, look, I'm thinking of going to Gracie Baja. It's up to you. What do you think? I said, dude, wherever you go, I'm going to go. We've trained together for years. Wherever you go, I'm going to go with you. I was a purple belt. Mark was a brown belt at the time. And
who did you get? You got your purple belt from Mauricio?
No, Hoyce.
Hoyce.
Yeah.
And Mark got his brown belt from Mauricio,
I think.
Okay. I'm going to get him on the podcast.
Yeah, I think.
To be confirmed.
Yeah, later day.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, wherever you go, man. So obviously went through that, got my brown belt under Baja, all the way up to black belt from Mark and Mauricio, because I think Mark was only the new one stripe black belt, first degree. And you can't give a black belt if you're first degree.
Yeah.
So he brought Mauricio in. Mauricio honoured it. And Mark gave me and Dave Elliott our black belt at the same time.
When was that?
2009.
Okay, yeah.
Beginning of 2009.
Because Mark got it graded in 2006.
Yeah.
So, but okay,
I was a brown belt for a long time.
There was a big gap between those two.
Yeah. It's like from training, I said to people, it took me 13 years to get a black belt from training. And I was training all the time as well. I mean, I did MMA, went to the World Championships, did that, done Europeans, I was doing a lot, and it still took me 13 years to get it. But the pace of learning, because of how many people are training, to how many gyms
the collective
gyms
knowledge
are,
isn't as much, you know, as accessible as it is now.
No, it wasn't. Because for me, like when I teach, people are amazed. I can remember every single thing that was taught to me, from Hickson to Mauricio Costa, from Hoja to Hoyce to Mauricio to Mark. I can remember every single lesson and every single detail.
I think that's
to do from my art side visually, because I can I've got like an eidetic memory where I can remember stuff visually very well.
Is that like a photographic memory?
Yeah, but it's with images.
So movement, not just stationary.
Yeah. I can watch a fight and work out how the person's done it.
Sure.
But I think it's because of the lack of knowledge, because I've tried to work out why I can remember, because people are amazed. They go, damn, you can remember like every little detail of everything. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, because what I think it is because the knowledge was so, you know, sparse at that time.
You had to focus so much. Yeah.
There was no cameras on your phone or no YouTube. I'd have to remember everything, because then I'd have to come back. Yeah. Like if I went to train with Mark and he'd show me something, I was like, can't forget it. So I'd have to really focus on every detail. So when I'd come back with my guys, I could teach what I'd learned properly.
Do you think that that's like a problem these days, is that nobody has to focus on anything so much?
Generally.
Because there's no fear that they're not going to be able to basically replay it, you know?
Well, you mean generally in our world, generally?
Yeah, and applicable to jiu-jitsu as well. So, for example, when you're watching a technique, you may video it on your phone. And then, like, are you paying that much attention to the technique, even the first time? Because you're not, like... Imagine a door opens and then it closes forever.
Yeah.
You're going to get through that door.
Well,
but what if the door just stays unlocked and you can open it whenever you want? So you're never like you're kind of alluding to that it was the ultra high focus that was generated as a necessity because you got one shot to remember this.
Yeah.
People don't have what with phones, with YouTube, with Facebook, with I'm going to go to class tomorrow and ask the instructor again. Yeah. They don't need to remember every detail.
No one was holding my hand. And I think, you know, and the thing is, back then it was, I think it's almost like a generation thing, one generation to the other. People now almost take it for granted that, you know, like, and especially I feel for me, it was like, absolute gold dust. And when I teach people stuff now, which is an accumulation of what I've learned over 20 years, and I'll show them something and they're like at blue belt level, and I'll show them like an escape to an armbar that's like, you know, or an escape to a triangle, that I think, man, when I was a blue belt, if I had have known that when I was a blue belt. And they take it like it's throwaway.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, you don't realize how amazing this is. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You want to sit people down and go, listen, pay attention, appreciate this, like consciously appreciate this, because I, you know, I'll teach my white belt something that I've only worked at in the last year.
Yeah, same as.
So it's a game changer.
Same as.
You know, I'll just be like, look, you guys have no idea how lucky you are that you're not going to have to train for 10 years like I did to work this out.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're
going
to get given it to you on your third class.
100%. You know? Yeah. And you're the same. It doesn't drive me mad, but I just think...
I feel like...
You're so lucky.
Yeah. I feel like they're lucky, but also like I'm so glad that that's the case.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that we are progressing. Like I'm so glad that I can teach something and not, you know, I can look at someone and I can say, do this, instead of looking at someone going, in 10 years time, you'll work out how to do this.
Yeah.
You know, and hopefully they will then in turn be able to teach someone something that took them 10 years and teach it to a beginner on their first class.
Well, it's like the thing. I mean, at the moment, I keep saying to people in training, especially as I'm getting older and stuff like that, is for my jiu-jitsu, I want it to be a profound jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is I don't want it to just be a collection of techniques of like, you know, oh, 1 minute this is in, that is in. I want to have for my own self, you know, and if I could pass that on, great. I want a really deep understanding of the construct of jiu-jitsu and why it works the way that it does. And I've been working on it. I've been showing principles to a lot of my guys on why it works and how it works. And I've been studying tape of high level guys and this, that, and the other, and drawing my concepts against what I'm watching and realizing why it's working and why it's not working. And when they hit these concepts, it works. When they don't, they struggle. And it takes time, and the amount of focus it takes to do that as well is quite a lot. But then you give it over and guys go, oh yeah. And I go, dude, you don't understand how.
Because I've been experimenting with this concept for the last 3 years.
And it's just concepts like, I mean, I was saying to my friend on the way down here that at the moment I'm working on three different concepts, which are like really game changing. They have been for me in the last year or so. Which is, one is angles, and which all grappling goes down to wrestling,
Totally.
Whatever. One, angles, two, weight distribution, and three, connection. If you follow them rules, no matter where you're doing, from stand up to the ground, underneath, on top, if you follow them rules, and they're done in specific ways of, you've got to understand when to do it and when not to do it,
yeah,
and point of pressure and stuff like that, that you don't need millions of techniques. You just got to follow the basics of what you're doing. And I mean, I do it with guys now. I pass with no hands within like two, maybe one or two moves.
Yeah.
Whatever guard. Doesn't really matter what guard it is. And yes, I'm sure there's guys out there that I might compete and I'll try it and they give me a really hard time, maybe sweep me or you know, but that's all about progression, eh? We can't beat everyone. But it won't stop me from testing them theories. And maybe I'll come back to go, oh, I've got to change this a little bit. Maybe I thought it was this and it's not, and coming back. But you know, it's things like that. It's taken a long, long time for me to get to this point of where very simple principles and concepts are what you need, or the structure of what you need to do very well in jiu-jitsu. You don't need, as we all know, I mean, once you pass that threshold of how many techniques is enough, you start realizing it's not about the techniques.
It's about how you put them together and how you think and view it as the overall picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're the main three things I'm working on at the moment is angles, weight distribution, and connection.
Yeah.
And
interesting.
And they're the three things, and they're really game changing.
Yeah.
Yeah. They really are.
Interesting. So how long have you been teaching jiu-jitsu for? Because what's your gym? It's Gracie Baja Hastings, right?
Yeah. What, real jiu-jitsu or kind of freestyle jiu-jitsu?
Let's go with real jiu-jitsu.
Okay.
Because freestyle jiu-jitsu since like 96, 97, right?
Yeah, but
20 years.
Yeah. Yeah, 21 years. I mean, I say like since I've been messing about with it.
Now your freestyle jiu-jitsu turned into, they're not two separate things.
Yeah.
Your freestyle jiu-jitsu developed into your, what you quote as real jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all real jiu-jitsu, yeah. But it's okay, now we're actually, I've actually learned it off someone legit, and I'm actually, I've got the knowledge firsthand, and I'm starting to teach it.
Sensei
VHS. Yeah. No, probably since, I went to America, came back from America, put white belt back on and started.
That's when it started?
Yeah, that's when it started properly.
So when,
was 98.
Wow, very early, very early. So, so you've been teaching for 20 years.
Yeah, over that. I started teaching karate when I was 18.
Wow.
So yeah, longer than that,
yeah. What have you, do you have a full-time gym now, right?
Yeah.
So what have you, and it's your full-time job?
It is, thanks to my wife, who earns a lot more money than I do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it full-time. Let's just get that clear. Yeah.
How have you changed as an instructor in 20 years? You know, like, and I'm not even talking from, because I've been teaching jiu-jitsu for about 10 years, and I feel like that's a long time, but you've been teaching it for double that.
Mm-hmm.
So like, even not even in the first couple of years, you know, after you've been training for teaching for 10 years, you're like probably you're like a high level brown belt. You're almost a black belt at that point.
Yeah.
So even in the 10 years that you've, almost 10 years that you've been a black belt, how have you, if any, has your style of teaching changes, your mythology, your philosophy to teaching changed?
God, that's a difficult question.
I know, mate.
That's really deep.
Mm.
God.
Getting deep. Shovels are out today.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, to be honest, I don't think your knowledge changes, so your depth of your subject changes. With me, it's got more simple, the way I teach. I thought, to begin with, I needed to impress people. Show them this, Baron Bowler, this jumping, let's do jumping this, jumping that. And then you realise it's not all about that. Then moves are great, but yeah, for me, it's more simple because...
100%.
I used to think, oh, it's about the amount I teach in the class. If I show 15 techniques, everyone's going to leave and go, wow, that was amazing. But it's actually quite the opposite of where you don't need to show as much, but you need it to be broken down better.
Yeah.
You know, so it's clearer.
It's not necessarily what you teach, it's how you show those things.
Yeah, and how and the way you construct it as well, there's got to be some pattern to it. So you can move from A to B, the type of flow that, and the reason, the rationale why you're doing behind something.
Yeah.
I mean, I've, and I think it comes from, you know, not everyone can teach. Not everyone can. There's a lot of really, you know, great instructors, but the opposite as well. There's a lot of guys that are brilliant at doing jiu-jitsu and they're killers, but they just can't. And all it comes down to is, and it's nothing to do with personality, because some of them guys are great personalities.
Very charismatic, yeah.
It's to do with basically transference of information. They can't transfer the information properly.
Well, especially a lot of people who have done jiu-jitsu, and obviously there's lots of exceptions, but a lot of people who have done jiu-jitsu since they were kids, they have an incredible subconscious grappling IQ.
Yeah.
But it's not conscious. If you do it since you were a kid and it's autonomous to you,
yeah,
by the time you are 15, 16, 17, by the time you're an adult, you're doing things automatically and incredibly well.
Yeah.
Well, how the fuck are you going to explain to a 30-year-old white belt how to do it?
Yeah.
Because you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know. You just learn over a ridiculous amount of time how to do it. You don't actually know what to do.
And because I started later as well.
You think that helps you? You had to be more conscious of what was going on from the beginning.
Yeah, the pace of the information, the way it was coming to me, was very slow nowadays. What took me 3 months to learn, you probably learn in your first 10 minutes of a class.
But would you say that the longer it takes for something to set, the stronger it's going to set?
I'd like to think so, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my understanding of the basics and is I believe very strong.
Yeah.
You know, my understanding of the art is like everyone that's trained or learned from me calls me a jiu-jitsu encyclopedia, which is I take great pride and honor in that more than a lot of things, because it just shows my understanding of the art and the way things work. And what shocked me the most is when I've been on the mat with like really well-known guys I've looked up to that have done great in, because you know, you've got to see it from my point of view. I've come from, you know, VHS tapes to this to that, and I've been locked down in Hastings, which you become like in a little fishbowl almost, and the world outside of it, and you're just, you know, you're into your own days, you're doing what you're doing, you're training, you know, you're just trying to get better, you know, you're not trying to rule the world, I'm just doing what I'm doing, and then just concentrating on my own development and development of my club. And then you get to be on the mat with these legendary figures sometimes, and I'll be going over stuff and I'll show something, and then they go, huh, show me that again, and I go over it and I'll break it down, they go, damn, that's really good. I'll be taken back and shocked. Yeah, yeah. But then you hit the realization of, yeah, no one knows everything.
No one knows everything. You can't. Yeah. It's limitless. Yeah. It is.
Yeah. But I'm like, man, I never thought that I would get to a point of where I could show these type of individuals something that they don't know. And it's kind of like, it's almost like validation for myself that I'm not kind of, I do know more than just an armbar, you know what I mean? If that makes sense.
I have a theory as to why that might happen to you in particular, which is that you, and very much to do with your fishbowl of being away from everywhere else, that you've connected with people in order to have some sort of mentorship, have some sort of instruction, get you through the belts and everything. But for the most part, you've been isolated.
Yeah.
When you're isolated, in the same way that, kind of from an evolutionary perspective, when you have like a you have a species of bird and one of them ends up, you know, the plates shift and they end up on an island and they can't connect with them, and then suddenly those birds on that island that don't have any connection to their other species evolve in a very different way, and when they come and meet back with each other, you're actually looking at two different species now, you know. Which is, you know, you understand what I'm saying?
So
because you've been isolated, you've evolved in a different way. I think that if you were talking to someone who had been training for as long as you have, or even if you took a clone of yourself, but you were an instructor at Roger Gracie Academy in London, you would not have as much of an individuality to your jiu-jitsu?
No.
As you do because you're isolated away?
Of course, and Hodges' fingerprints would be all over my game.
Yeah. Like, and that would be, in my opinion, one of the reasons why you could go into rooms with high-level guys and show them something different, because you've evolved very independently of many other outside sources.
Yeah, and makes whether sense. It's better or worse, who knows? I mean, it's only the person. It depends whether it works for them, what I'm showing.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't think in jiu-jitsu there is necessarily a better and worse. It's a very individual basis. I think the more variations of something there is, the better.
Yeah.
The more variations, the better. Yeah. You know, the wider the spectrum is, the more good stuff can be encompassed in that spectrum.
Oh, of course. Of course. And, and that's the thing is... And when I read things about, and I always think to myself, am I a bit of a charlatan because I didn't have like a black belt who was, you know what I mean? It's kind of that kind of thing, because I've not been under someone the way that you've been under Nick or whatever and stuff like that. But then I read things, and then you come back to people like Carlos and Ilio, where they were shown a very minimum. I think it was 3 years maximum.
Yeah,
that, and they developed everything spent else. With him.
Yeah,
yeah, and then Ilio didn't. I heard that, you know, correct me if I'm wrong and whatever, but I heard that Ilio really never spent any time with Miade. It was mostly Carlos.
Yeah, yeah.
So but then from that. Because he didn't do it as much, he kind of had to work it out himself, and then a different beast started to happen. And
when you have like a more missing pieces of the puzzle, and you have to fill that in yourself, it's going to look different to if you had more. You know.
And that's what I've had to do. Why doesn't this work? And then have to fix it kind of on my own to a degree. Obviously, with help, I'm not putting down, because many people have helped me so much and I'm really grateful for that. But on a day-to-day basis, I've had to kind of, you know, they're not there holding my hand when someone's smashing me with the shoulder of justice, and I have to kind of work out little bits and bobs of how to take the pressure off, get into a position of where I'm not getting crushed and survive until I can escape and stuff like that. But it comes down to that thing of being your own master, which eventually we have to be anyway. But I think that, you know, because once you have your own academy, you have to start doing that. And anyway, but it's been like that from a very early beginning with, you know, as you say, with mentorships from certain individuals and stuff like that. But but that was the same for Elio and the guys in Brazil originally. They had to be their own masters.
Yeah.
All the family did originally, because there was no Japanese master showing them how to do it.
Yeah.
So that's where our whole system comes from.
Yeah, I think like a lot of people are under the impression that the person who gave the Gracies jiu-jitsu, you know, was their instructor for 30 years and mentored them all the way down and kind of put all of the jiu-jitsu into the Gracie family, and then it was adapted.
Yeah, it was trial and error.
Yeah, like had Maeda spent it's a very interesting subject now you put it like that, because I've never thought about it, which is, had Maeda spent an indefinite amount of time with the Gracies, because he was teaching them, but they teaching them judo.
Yeah, yeah, but they know? Wouldn't have had the space or the scope to change it.
Well, this is what I'm saying. This is what I'm saying.
He would have stopped them, yeah?
Yeah, like, had Maeda spent more time with the Gracies, there wouldn't be no such thing called Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
No, because if they had done something slightly different, it'd have got no... Because, I mean, the Japanese are very much that way.
Yeah.
Of like, there are rules and there's this and there's that, and they want it done in a particular way.
They'd just be another... They'd be another random person doing judo. That's all and we wouldn't be having this conversation and this podcast wouldn't exist and the listeners wouldn't be doing jiu-jitsu because just some, like, lots of people would do judo and they'd just be a random family of Brazilians doing judo.
And it's decisions made as well, same thing by the Gracies. They did from Japan, when they came over with Kimura and people like that, they did offer them to become part of the Japanese.
They offered the Gracies?
Yeah, yeah. But they wanted to change it to judo.
Yeah.
So they went, no. I mean, this is like 50s, 60s, something like that. I don't know. But they kind of, because they were so impressed with what they saw, they wanted them to be part of that association, but they had to change it and be judo. So it would be like Gracie judo or whatever.
Yeah.
No, but you can imagine. I mean, that's a big offer from like the main people, especially when you're... in a country of Brazil, which is not known, you might as well say Cuba, you know, it's not known for its prowess in jiu-jitsu or judo. And to have that offer, it was probably very intriguing, but you know, they stuck to their guns and
thankfully.
Yeah, thank God.
Yeah, it's interesting actually. And kind of you mentioned there about being your own master is very, very, very interesting. Obviously, a lot of people hear that and there's a certain amount of time into it. You know, a lot of people, you can't train for a couple of years and then decide that you're going to open your own school and you never need to learn anything again, which kind of...
Dude, I got VHS and decided to open my school.
Yeah, but it's not 1997 anymore.
No, exactly.
You can't do that anymore. Yeah. You wouldn't get away with that.
I miss them days.
The BJJ police would be on you like that right now.
I miss them days. I don't know if you ever had it at Nick's or Hodges or how long you've been going on for, but the tough judo guys or... Yeah. Guys with wrestling backgrounds that come in that kind of, you know why they're there. They're a bit, some are a bit more obvious, some are not. But I had that very early on, you know what I mean? Yeah,
you were doing, you were like the first person doing Gracie challenges in the UK.
Especially I'm standing there, skinny guy, white belt on, you know. I mean, I had one night a conversation with the same guy, I'd not seen him in like 15 years or something like that.
Yeah.
And he brought one of his friends down to my school now. And I mean, guy's massive. He's about 30 stone. I mean, he's overweight now. He says he can't do it. He's got a problem walking now and stuff like that. But this was like 15 years ago when he was a bit younger. And he come down to my school and he had a catch wrestling background. And he used to teach catch and stuff like that. And he'd been wrestling for a long time. Must be about 6'4", 6'4 and a half. 260-70 pound. I'm
beast.
Not even joking. Yeah,
beast.
And I'm like, this is what I need on my mat. Is this? And he's like, oh yeah, I do catch and all that. And I'm like, oh mate, But anyway, he said the only point he was sold, because he said, to be honest, he said, I looked at it and thought, what am I going to learn from someone of your size? I've heard of this jiu-jitsu stuff, but I kind of want to, you know, want to see what it's about and give it a go. And he said, you were demonstrating like a headlock escape, basic self-defense technique. And he said, like, you said, get me in a headlock. And he said, in all the years I've been doing wrestling,
no one's ever got out of a headlock.
No one's ever got out of my headlock.
Yeah.
And he said, you got it in. And he said, I squeezed it as hard as I could and make sure, because I'm in the Kezakatami position, make sure, like Josh Barnett kind of style.
Sure.
And at that point, I felt him squeeze and I was like, this better work.
Because
the biggest guy I ever had do it on me and with knowledge as well. And I just went through the steps, frame, skip, got his neck, flipped him over, got on top, you know, and stuff like that. And I was only demonstrating, but he was one of them guys that he wanted like, okay, he knew I was teaching the technique, but it was like, right, I'll squeeze it as hard as I can. Which I was like, Jesus. But I didn't know at the time. It was only a few months ago when he brought his friend to the school and we were sitting down afterwards and we just, you know, chit-chatting. And he said, that's when he knew. He said...
He wanted to do that,
Yeah, he said, well, that's when he knew that it was...
Legit.
Jiu-jitsu was legit. He said, because to be honest, I didn't really think that much of it. And he said, because of his background, he didn't really, you know, whatever, I think I could do this and do that. And he said, and from the point of all the guys I've been with, no one's ever escaped it. And he said, a guy your size, he said, I never expected you'd be able to escape that move. And I was like, oh, well, thanks, you know, and stuff like that. But it was the same thing. I remember sparring with him and stuff back in the day, and it was like full on, like properly, like trying to bend things back and stuff like that. But that was like the Wild West back in them days. And that's what people don't kind of get now, which is I miss it, but I don't miss it, if you know what I mean. It was a time that will never be repeated, and I feel very honored and privileged to have gone through that and seen it from its inception.
What are the big differences from, you know, you have, and that I had no idea that it's possible that you and Mark Warder together were the very first people who ever did any variation of Brazilian jiu-jitsu in the UK. That would be interesting to see whether, you know, talk to other people who were very, very early in the game to see.
Yeah.
But that's a long time ago. You know, mid-90s, a long time ago.
I know, it just made me feel old.
I was 4 years old.
How old are you?
26.
Damn.
I know, I don't look it. My body doesn't feel it, but yeah. Apparently, I'm 26. That's what my driving license says.
No, but that's fair. I'm going for the marathon effect.
Yeah.
I don't want to smash my body up too much because I want to carry on doing it until
Too late for me now. I'm working on that now. So what is like the big way, what have you seen changed from, and also the other thing which is interesting for you, which is you spent, not only have you spent time in America,
Yeah.
But you spent time in America in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, not today in America or in the
2000s. Oh, it's still karate schools
in the 90s. So like, what was it like in America? Like the, from source, because the whole thing with the Gracies is that like they're famously fiery, hot tempered, aggressive, badass guys, yeah. But they've calmed down so much. They've really been sedated, if anything, by that transition from Brazil, which is crazy hot.
You have to.
In Brazil, yeah. And then in America, you can't be Brazilian, like pure Brazilian in America, because you go to jail, yeah. And you can't be crazy pure Brazilian in the UK because you go to jail. And I remember, like in Legacy, Henzo's talking about, I love coming back to Brazil because I am free. You know, I can do what I want here, and you can't do that anywhere else. So, like, when the Gracies came over to America to kind of cash in on jiu-jitsu and spread jiu-jitsu mainstream, there was a transitionary phase where they had to release, exhaust some of that fiery Brazilian mentality.
Yeah,
but you got in there whilst that was still happening before they had been, you know. Sedated, yeah, I mean, to a degree.
You know, with some academies, it's still really clicky now. But I remember at Hickson's gym, because I used to see Hoxton there a lot. And because he was training quite a lot at the time. And it was his friend who came into the gym, but he had, you know, another logo on his gi.
Uh-oh.
And yeah, and he's supposed to be his friend as well. I've never seen anything like it. It was like the air turned blue, everyone stepped back, and he's like, you know, what are you doing wearing that?
How old was Hoxton at the time?
98. I don't know, he's 17, 18.
He's
like
older
that.
Than Crone, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, he's his older brother.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Hoxton was unfortunately one of Hickson's older son who passed away.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how.
No one's really sure. Yeah.
But yeah, so he's 17. He's a teenager at the time. His buddy, who I assume is around about the same age, comes into the academy, but we're in a rival academy. And I say rival academy, when I say rival academy, I mean different academy. Because in those days, if it was a different academy, it was a rival academy.
Yeah.
So he comes in with a rival academy. He might as well come and spat on Hickson's feet.
Yeah. And he's like one of his friends as well. It wasn't like just a random guy. It was one of his friends. Yeah. And he was like, take it off. Take it off now. And he's like, what? And he's like, take it off. I'm going to fuck your ass. Take it off right now. How dare you? Blah, blah, blah. And but that's the different mentality. It's such a big thing. And now people might frown and look, but that's, you know, that's just the way it was and what it is.
Did that come to blows?
No. He
took it off.
Yeah, he took it off. He looked really kind of embarrassed, really ashamed, and kind of, oh, no, well, come on, like that. And he's just like, don't care, dude. You take it off. And that was it. And it's kind of, and it's hard for people to understand, but I get it. I get it. You know
so
what I mean?
What was the, why? That crazy, singular loyalty, you're in or out, very black and white, binary, loyalty-based philosophy back in the old days. And for some people, still the same today.
Yeah.
There will be some gyms in the UK who won't be happy with someone training with another gym's patch on.
Yeah.
You know? And I, like, they can come to my academy. I have an open door policy. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Anyone can train with me. But some people don't have the same mentality for that. So, what do you think it was that, what was it, just fiery Brazilian tempers, or was it something deeper than that?
No, I just think it's you know, jiu-jitsu's everything to them, and their you know, and their family's built over so long that it means so much to them, and I do understand it in the sense of, because I explained this to a guy before, that he trained with me, this was years ago, he trained with me, but then he, because he thought he could get a belt promotion, went somewhere else, got a belt promotion, then come back and still wanted to train. And I said, well, no. I said, and it's up to him, everyone's free to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
But I said, let's put it this way. When you go to a competition, whose badge is going to be on your back? What flag are you going to be waving.
Yeah.
You know, and he said, oh, well, probably this team. And I said, well, you've made the choice. You've made the choice for yourself. I said, that's fine, but you've got to go and train with them guys.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a completely different kind of thing.
Yeah, well, someone pissing off to get a belt and coming back, that's not cool. Yeah. We've had that before. We've had people ask for belts, just straight up, I want to go and do this. I want to fight in this competition, or I want to go and work here. I need this belt. Can I get it? And you're like, that's the number one rule in jiu-jitsu. You do not ask for belts.
Or you'd probably be on that belt for a little bit longer.
Well, that's 6 months,
Yeah.
Whenever you were going
to
get it.
Yeah, that's like answering back to your dad.
Yeah, you're going to get it tomorrow. You were going to get it tomorrow, and you ask when you're getting your belt. Yeah. You're getting it in at least 6 months' time. Yeah.
It's like saying, you're grounded. Where long for? It'll be another
Yeah, exactly,
another
exactly. Another okay, week? 2 weeks. Yeah. Fuck you. Yeah. 3 weeks.
Yeah. It's kind of like that. I just think that it's only changed because of it's now in the UK and in America, and people see, well, I'm paying for a service. I didn't sign up to be part of this gang and thinking I can't train here and I can't train there. And you know, and we're very much like that as nations. You're not going to tell us that we can't, if we're defiant, paying for a service as such, we can't pay. But saying that, I do strongly believe in loyalty to people. You know what I mean? I'm very loyal, but it goes both ways, as I always say. As any student out there, I'm super loyal to my any of my students.
Yeah.
And I just naturally would want the same back and kind of almost expect it, like, in that sense. So I find it really odd if I give loyalty that it's not given back. But but it goes both ways. And that's the thing. And if I've, been involved with individuals or whichever, and I've given my loyalty to them and they've not given it back to me and whichever, then I've had no problem with going, well, that's fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm very loyal to you, but you're not loyal to me.
It's got to be a two-way street.
I think
there's nothing wrong with loyalty, but instructors can't expect loyalty for them and not give anything back. And likewise, the students can't expect loyalty from their instructors and not give anything back to them.
Yeah.
So it's very important that it is a two-way street. So you said you've been competing in jiu-jitsu for 20 years. You are still competing in jiu-jitsu now, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Trying.
So I had a conversation with Ash Williams a little while ago, and I asked him a question that I want to ask you the same question. The question is, what do you consider yourself more a, and I assume I know the answer to this question, are you a fighter or are you a coach?
I'm an instructor. Yeah.
You're an instructor.
Yeah, for sure.
But was there any time that you were a fighter above or a competitor above an instructor?
With me, the only reason I ever really competed was to kind of, especially back when I was competing, and I competed in MMA and stuff like that as well, it was in them early days to kind of prove jiu-jitsu. It was the kind of when I had done MMA, very similar time to when Mark Wald had done MMA, Dave Elliott, we were all on that same team. And we all kind of...
When did you fight MMA?
Was it early 2000s?
Was it even called MMA at the time? Was it still No Holds Barred?
Yeah. Well, the first...
Valitudo or whatever.
Well, the first ones I did were in the ring.
Yeah.
Because there was only... I think when I first did it, there was only, or there might not have even been, but there was only one cage in the country, I think, at that point. So when I did it, it was in a ring, and it was at the Circus Tavern, where the Tough is.
Yeah. Oh, wicked.
Under Lee Johnson. That's same funny, thing, man. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So yeah. Lee's old school.
Yeah. Lee's been around.
I'm
going to
get
years.
Lee on here as well.
Yeah. I did it in a ring, and first fight, purple belt at the time. Fought this guy who was 7 times European kickboxing champion and purple belt in jiu-jitsu, and I thought, and it was one of them. You understood as soon as you do it in a ring why to have a cage, because
you're falling out of the ring. Yeah.
Well, exactly, I did.
Holding on,
held on to the ropes. He was trying to hold on to the ropes. Took me a while to get him down. Done a takedown, got on top of him. As soon as I started hitting him from the mount,
he's running out.
He pulled himself out. I followed him through the ropes, still hitting him. They had to drag us back in. And then I thought, that's all right, it'll start from the ground. No, stand up. I was like, you kidding me? Yeah. This guy. But then Mark's going in the corner, Paul, just concentrate on what you're doing. Don't get annoyed with the ref. Don't get annoyed. Just concentrate. So I went back in, did that, won that one, was very happy. Did a few more fights, and, but the thing is, obviously I'm raising a family at the time and coming home bruised up and no money in it. And the amount of time and effort you have to, you know, work on.
The stakes are very high for MMA.
Yeah, very. And you have to work on the stand-up, the wrestling, the cardio, the jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And plus I'm teaching at the time as well. So I'm trying to do that and teach and have a full-time job and have a family. And for all the guys that have done MMA out there or dabbled in it, you know, it's tough. It's really tough.
So, like, what is it like trying to get that balance? Even nowadays, like, I know you're still trying to compete. You competed on the Los Polaris. You competed in Tough. So you're not even just rocking up to tournaments. You're going to, like, proper sub-only shows.
Yeah.
Like, what's the balance between, like, being an instructor, being a competitor, being a husband, being a father, three kids, you know, everything?
You just got to find time to do it. My wife hates it. She said, you said you were going to retire when you were like 35. Mm. You're in your 40s now. You're still going. And I'm like, yeah, but I still feel all right. I said, but my rationale was, like, I'll give it a few goes. If my performance starts deteriorating, because I've seen it with fighters a lot, you know, where they go for too long. And it's not like being unlucky. It's just your performance is not there anymore. You're making silly mistakes you should never make. You've got no cardio. And it's not even nice to watch.
Yeah.
But my performance started getting better. Everyone has started getting better. My cardio was there. My confidence was there more. My last match was just not worth talking about, really. Yeah. But on up to Polaris, my performances I felt were quite good. I remember you commentating with me and Alan, and you were saying
that was a great match.
But you were saying, you went, "Oh, two guys is older, like he's in like 40s now. There's no way these guys are going to do another takedown." I think I hit another three because of how long it was.
Like I remember by the end of that, I was saying, like, these kids need to start watching these two guys in their 40s just going for it for the entire match, just going for it nonstop. Yeah. And then you have kids who are coy and playing it safe and all of that stuff.
Well, I've got nothing to lose. And I went through that as well, playing
that's
it
what it
safe.
Looked like. That's what you, when you want to watch a jiu-jitsu match, the biggest thing that can kill visually, entertainment-wise, can kill a jiu-jitsu match is the competitors feeling like they have something to lose.
Yeah,
because they'll play it safe.
Yeah, but that's what killed a lot of my matches going to tournaments and stuff like that, because I would go to a tournament and being an instructor, primary, not a fighter, I don't consider myself, I'm not a natural athlete.
Sure.
I'm not conditioned, like, you know, obviously I'm conditioned through doing jiu-jitsu, but I'm not naturally strong physically. Look, I'm not built like a big guy. Can't really do chin-ups. Can't really, you know, I'm not that way. I wouldn't say I'm weak or I'm kind of like, oh my God, I'm playing a sob story. But, you know, I've rolled with enough guys and they're athletes and they're not athletes. And I know the difference. I wouldn't consider myself an athlete just because I've trained with enough of them that I know what they feel like and I know how they move. But I'm an instructor first. But the thing is, that's what killed my game a lot when I went to a lot of different competitions, was all my students would be by the side. And I was really worried.
There's a lot of pressure there for you.
Yeah, because like if you teach people, you're worried that they're, because they expect so much from you, they look up to you, and because you're being able to tap them in class and dominate, they in your head, but they expect me to do that here today. And the thing is, I'd go in with like the idea that, like, I start the match, I want to win, but if the guy's tough, it starts getting tough, as long as I don't lose, as long as I don't get tapped, I'm fine. So I play it safe.
Yeah.
And the guy wouldn't be able to tap me, but I wouldn't win either because you can't win by not doing anything.
No,
you can survive you by not doing anything, but you can't win by playing safe.
Do you know what I see it as? Like, I totally understand what you're saying. There's a lot of pressure coming from the students for you to perform well, but that you put on yourself, you know? And I think the way that I see it, especially the more advanced a student is, the more, and that once they've been competing for a while, they understand how fickle a competition will be. But
this is the biggest, which is what I was wanting to say earlier. This is one of the biggest things, one of the best things today in jiu-jitsu that's happening, rather than years ago, was when I learned it from that Gracie lineage, and I still Gracie jiu-jitsu all the way. Break me in half, I've got Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, and I love Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, like the whole system. But it was that idea, like coming from that Hickson camp, coming from the Hoist camp, coming from that kind of thing. You don't tap. Yeah. We don't tap. Because that's all I saw. When you consider, if you look at Hoist doesn't tap.
Yeah.
Look at Hickson, he's going to die. You're not going to tap. You see these guys. Like,
is that philosophy outdated?
Well, I think physically, my arms don't straighten properly. Look at my arms. They don't straighten properly anymore.
Because you weren't tapping.
Man, I wouldn't tap. In hindsight,
I
wish I'd have been of. No, I think it's just a different time of the way people look at it now. That hopefully they do. That it's okay to tap.
Yeah, but like, what I'm asking is it out like that mentality that you don't?
If
tap,
I didn't have that mentality, the last Polaris with Jeff, I wouldn't have tapped. I'd let him break my arm.
Well,
and he almost did.
That's good then, right? It's good that you got over that mentality.
Yeah, yeah. And my arm popped about 7 times before I tapped, but it was so quick.
Yeah.
And if Jeff's listening, well done, Jeff. Beautiful technique.
It was.
Flawless. And I'm still in awe of what happened.
Yeah.
No, and I am. And I really appreciate that. And I can look at it. And I always
say, it's
a
great attitude to have.
Well, I always say to people that, you know, one of my biggest things is I'm not, you know, for me, I'm not just fascinated when things work for me. You know, I'm more fascinated when they work against me.
Yeah.
So when someone does something that I'm like, damn, what was that? How? And I think I've been like that since day one, personally. But I think most people are fascinated when things work for them. They love that. Oh, this worked. And if it doesn't work for them, they go, oh, but I'm more fascinated by that. I don't kind of brush it off and go, oh, that shouldn't have happened. I'm like, why did that happen? Can you show me how you did that?
Yeah.
Or I want to break that down. It's kind of a little bit more like that. And I think if everyone thought like that, I mean, I don't know, because there's so many gyms out there now. I'm not sure how they're being, how they're being perceived, what's being taught, you know, like that thing on Facebook this week with that absolute bell end with the beard.
Yeah.
And I want to chop his legs off for having the Gracie Baja bottoms on.
Yeah.
Who's teaching?
Yeah.
Who's doing it? Spreading's good. Growing's good. But at what rate? And at what?
You cannot spread and not have some dilution or loose control. You know, if you have a flock of 5 sheep, it's easy to keep them together. If you have a flock of 1,000 sheep, then it becomes a bit harder.
Mm.
If you have a flock of 1,000,000 sheep, you can't keep them together. You're gonna lose some sheep.
Yeah, how are you gonna pen them all?
It's simple as that. Yeah. You can't. The bigger it gets, and everyone does want it to get bigger, but it's this double-edged sword where it's going to get bigger, and we are going to get, people like right now. We are in a transitionary period where, between being able to really moderate and control our black belts, who's a black belt,
yeah.
You know, this on the UK underground, the BJJ police, and we can go, this guy's a black belt. Who'd you get your black belt from? He can't answer. He's not real black belt. Well, it's start going to get into the point where there are so many black belts, it's going to start getting very, very hard to trace the lineage down. Yeah. And you have someone, you know, you have...
What's the average time on a black belt now?
I would probably say that the average time for a black belt is between 9 and 12 years.
Oh, really? I thought we shortened that now.
I
think that's about the right amount of time, to be honest.
Yes, me too. I think for some people it will be shorter because you have the ability now to train so much more often than we did back in the day.
Do you think then people have to be like absolute phenoms to do that?
Yeah, 100%. Okay. I think like people are getting their black belts in 5, 6, 7, 8 years. They need to be, and the only way that you should be getting your black belt below 9 years, 8, 9 years, in my opinion, the only way is you've won everything at every belt. You know, if you're winning the British, the English, the Europeans. Yeah, exactly. Competitive. If you're not competing, there is no reason to be pushing someone through the belt so fast.
So where's your thoughts on, because I have the discussion a lot, and it used to be gi or no gi. Right?
Okay.
But now it seems, but now it seems the argument's gone not that anymore so much.
Yeah.
I don't think really many people playing that game anymore.
Gi versus no gi?
Yeah, not too much.
I think it's definitely still a decision. Like, it's a discussion, sorry.
Yeah. But now it's more self-defense sport. Like, it seems like a lot of people. Like,
I would say that.
And I've got good friends on the thing that, because for me, I think I sit in a really interesting chair as far as that goes, because I've trained on the Elio side, trained on the Carlos side, from both trains of thought, and they're the same, slightly different, but the same.
So you like train much self-defense, Gracie, old school Gracie?
I know the whole syllabus, yeah.
What's your take on it?
Oh, well, thing is, when you look at it, it looks like karate self-defense 101.
Yeah.
When you look at it.
Yeah.
When you it's almost like looking at jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Cuddle club, yeah? Yeah, you doing cuddle? Yeah. Well, all the kickboxers used to watch us. Yeah. Oh, what that cuddle club stuff? What are they cuddling? You can't see it so much. But with the self-defense, it takes time. Like, jiu-jitsu takes time to get good at it. You can't just, you know, oh, no, a headlock escape, no this, no, no, self-defense. You've got to kind of embed yourself a little bit in it. And the way that it was worked out, the way they fashioned it, it flows from one thing to another. And it's not endless either. There's X amount of movements the way you do it. And the movements cover so many different things. And they're major, rather than micro movements, they're major movements like an arm bar and this, that and the other. They're quite easy to use under duress and stress.
Yeah.
Amazing. The system is amazing, as in the sense of its self-defense. And I think it's a shame that it's one either not understood now because it's not been taught, or that
it's a dying art, isn't it?
Yeah, not many people know it.
I'll tell you my take on it. My take is that I have never done it. I know of it. We had some people come in and show various parts of it. We had Hayes and Gracie for a seminar who kind of did half Gracie defense stuff and half sport jiu-jitsu stuff, and Mauricio talks about it a lot. My take on it is I don't care. Is the answer. I'm not interested. Is the simple answer. Do I think it has a place?
Yeah.
Yes. Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
But for what you're trying to achieve, your time is best spent
because
you're a competitor,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I had someone message me on Instagram yesterday, actually, and they were asking about, what's your take on sport versus sport jiu-jitsu versus self-defense, and what does the academy do? I'm very transparent in that my desire is to build up a strong competition team.
Yeah.
Not everyone is interested in competing who trains with me, but for the most part, that is the sort of mentality, and a submission-based competition team opposed to a point-based submission team. I feel very safe when I walk the street. You know, I don't think we get put in that. A lot of self-defense stuff is common sense. I know
absolutely.
Some people will want to get into martial arts for self-defense.
Yeah.
The majority of people who come and train with me are not interested in getting into martial arts for self-defense. They're interested in getting into martial arts for competitiveness or enjoyment, fun, hobbies, movement, sport, lose weight, whatever. Not that many really get into self-defense. Self-defense is just an added bonus because it is going to help you. I feel safe and confident when I walk the streets. I'm not intimidated by people. That may be due to the fact that I am larger than some people.
Bit of a beast.
You know, like physically, I feel like I can handle myself, jiu-jitsu or not. And then also I feel like even though I would consider my grappling 100% sport grappling, if you want to call it that, opposed to, you know, if the other option...
Grappling's grappling.
Yeah, you know, well, like if the other...
Chokehold's chokehold.
Yeah, exactly.
It works the same whenever.
Exactly, like I'm 100% grappling if the other side of that is self-defense and 0% self-defense. I believe that my guillotine, I believe that my takedown and my knee on stomach is going to work me just on fine on the street. So for me personally, I don't see the necessity.
But would you consider self-defense, like as in the technique side of it, what's your viewpoint on the self-defense aspect of it?
I think self-defense is like, it's much more than the technique side of it, you know? Like, you can show it, and I think that's the problem that a lot of other martial arts have, and I believe that the Gracie self-defense system does incorporate a lot of the more the deeper issues when it comes to self-defense. Distance control, posture, movement, surroundings, thinking, de-escalation. Like the absolute best self-defense in the world is getting the fuck out of there.
Yeah, don't be there in the first place. You know? And like
don't
you
put
say,
yourself there. Get out, run. If you can't run, try and de-escalate. If you can't de-escalate, make sure you take care of the situation, all of that stuff. So it's a lot more than just like, you go to a lot of shitty self-defense class and they'll go, oh, someone's coming up to you. I'll pull out your lipstick and stick it in their eye and kick them in the nuts.
Exactly.
And that's bollocks.
I mean, for me, what... No pun intended, I mean, I learned it going along and I picked it up and I say I know the whole syllabus. I know I've looked in the books and, you know, for reference and stuff, and I know everything they're teaching and I've learned it before. So I'm sure there's stuff out there I probably don't know, and I'm learning different tricks all the time. But for what changed it for me was I was just teaching like just the sports stuff over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I had this little, this kid, who's 17, 18, and he just finished his A-levels. And on the day, and it, I can't speak too long about it because I start welling up. And he come and he was so happy. He bought his first gi and he put it in his bag and his white belt and all that. And he'd been training for a little while. And I was just teaching him. And it's not that it would have been any different, but I was just teaching him like just the sports stuff. And then he was going to be going to, because he was asking me about different academies where he can go and train. I gave him some contacts and stuff like that of where he was going to be at university. And then he went home past this pub and these like basic skagheads come outside, thought he was his brother, who was a small-time drug dealer, and stabbed him, killed him, stone dead. And... such a nice kid. I can't really speak about it too much because I will start being all manly and not welling up. And for me, and that's always, it's different for everyone. But for me, it was, I felt that if I know the information,
you should have, it was your duty to have given.
Yeah.
And even a little bit of that.
Yeah. Of being aware of what to do. Like you say, even if you can't stop it, because man, it's very hard. Yeah. You know what I mean? And that's a position you don't want anyone ever to be in. But that's where it kind of changed for me, that I wanted to kind of bring the self-defense part back. Cause I felt, man, I know this information and I'm not sharing it. It's almost like I'm cheap. Shortchanging my students to not share it. Like, I make it a part of the training. It's not all the class. I do both. I still teach.
Do you teach them as separate classes?
No.
Do you warm up with it, or do you just teach it as? Do you teach it as?
We do like one bit of self defense, and so now and again we do courses of like, okay, we do like just a workshop on baseball bat, how to, you know, if someone's swinging a baseball bat, another one knife defense. Another one kind of, you know, X, Y, and Z, whichever, you know, against a short club, or, you know, getting grabbed from behind, you know, whichever, depending on what we're on and what I feel the students need, what I haven't gone over in a while.
And you do that at just the basic classes or all classes? I know some academies, I think Simon Hayes, at his beginners, Carson Gracie London, he teaches self-defense stuff. Yeah. I remember him saying, just for beginners.
Yeah, no, I do it all classes. I always pepper it in. And some classes, we put the gloves on and do that as well, like puncture protection stuff, which I think is, you know, it's just nice, I think, for the students to know a few tricks and know if punctures are coming, how to kind of wrap the guy up and stuff like that, and control it. So it's not something that they've never been in that situation. Their brain understands of how to actually intercept this action happening, you know, against me. But for me, I'm open to everything. That's my thing. I like doing it all. I like doing a sport, as you've seen. I like doing the self-defense, and I like doing the gi, and I like doing the no gi. And
you prefer no gi, right?
I prefer competing no gi. Yeah.
What's your breakdown of your classes, gi to no gi?
In what respect?
Like how many, what percentage amount of the classes are taught for the gi and for no gi?
There's probably slightly more. It's probably 2/3 to 1/3. It used to be half and half.
Yeah? And you changed that?
Since I've been back with Gracie Barha, I've kind of structured my classes slightly different, like in the sense of, like, because of all the fundamental classes are in the gi. So because I put more fundamentals on in the week, it had to take the place of one or two of the no-gi.
Okay. Fundamentals have to be taught in the gi, yes or no? Because they tend to be.
Yeah.
They tend to be, but I don't believe that that's necessarily... I don't think that's necessary. A lot of people view no-gi as an advanced type of BJJ.
I think that if you want to... Personally, from an instructor's point of view, if you want to have more students, funnily enough, you're better off starting with a gi.
I beg to differ.
The only reason being is because it's easier to people to connect, I think. I might be completely wrong, but I think
a lot of people will agree with you.
A martial art, I'm wearing a gi, it's more kind of, you know, it's more clean. I understand it. It's got a belt, looks like karate, you know, because what you've got is the general public idea. It's not what you or me think. It's because we've been doing it so long now, you almost forget.
You had to pretend to be someone else.
From my point of view, if I was walking into this class not knowing anything, because it's super scary, coming into a martial arts class, any martial arts class, whether it's a tough martial arts class or a really, you know...
Chilled martial arts class.
Martial arts class, you know. Even to the ones that are super self-defense. And the thing is, sometimes I think there's a problematic way with that as well. I think you need both. You know what I'm saying about the sport and the self-defense? Because what I've started to see with some classes when I've watched stuff online, Facebook, stuff like that, and people post stuff, it's almost becoming like karate in the sense of it's very robotic. And that's the good thing about the sport, that it keeps it free flow and organic. And you've got a battle for it. And I know great self-defense guys and I know great sport guys.
Yeah.
But I think they both play a part, like hand in hand, helping one to the other. And, you know, and I've seen posts before with great friends of mine who have posted about certain individuals that do self-defense and, you know, like Gracie Jiu-Jitsu self-defense, and they're very high up in it. And they've gone, oh, it's this guy in his kind of karate suit, like this one step rubbish and blah, blah, blah. But I've actually trained, you know, because someone made a comment about Pedro Valente, and I've trained with him.
Yeah.
That guy is seriously legit and seriously very, very, very good. And it's kind of like, you know, that's the way it is now. People make comments about knowing people, and I just wouldn't. And all I know is that I've trained with a guy. I've done private with him and stuff like that. And he's very, very, very good. And his self-defense is like,
spot on.
Yeah, spot on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. Like, if you were to attack him with a knife, it'd be very hard to stab him. That's all I know. Mm. You know what I mean? But it's kind of like them that I keep on seeing popping up on Facebook and things like that is, you know, I think just be open-minded. You know what I mean? Yeah. And try it. If you don't like it, fair enough, if you don't like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of people do have that mentality with the gi and the no-gi that I understand what you're saying, that when someone comes to a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu academy, they're looking for a martial art and they have a preconceived notion of what a martial art is. Mm. And they want to see, essentially want to see cues that are going to confirm what their interpretation of what martial arts are.
Yeah.
So for example, they're going to come in, they're going to see uniform. They're going to see belts. These are already things that everyone knows about martial arts. They're going
to
see people lining up.
For them to get on board.
Exactly, exactly. But at the same time, I think that there's a group of people who do not come to a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu academy for those traditional aspects of martial arts. That actually, they come to and a lot of people immediately go, "Oh, well, you're thinking MMA fighters." Mm-hmm. You know, an MMA fighter goes to learn some grappling for MMA. They don't want to see the gi. You know.
Yep.
Oh, I'm going to let you out here a minute, don't worry. They don't want to see the gi. They want to see, you know, they can't, you know, I'm not going to be wearing a gi when I fight MMA. But actually, I run like a no-gi only program. Well, like some people sign up only to do no-gi.
Yeah.
We have a surprising number, like, surprisingly popular. But like some people come in and they literally go, and there's like a 50-50 split. Okay. People walk through the door and they go, I want to do gi. maybe I'll do no-gi when I'm advanced. And other people come through the door and they go, I want to do no-gi. I'm not interested in the gi. You know, so I do think it's a very, very interesting dynamic, the mentality of people who come in. You have half the people coming in looking to find the next evolution in a traditional martial art.
Yeah.
And you have other people who are looking to find something that specifically isn't a traditional martial art, where actually the cues, such as the belts, such as the gis, such as the lining up, potentially in some gyms, the bowing, is actually a turn-off, whereas for others it's a turn on. It's a very individual aspect.
Yeah, yeah, and some people really like that. See, I never used to do the bar. I used to do it exactly the way that I was taught: walk on the mat, walk off the mat. You know, but now I've been trying to kind of organize everything, make it much more organized, like team environment, to the way I run.
So you do
class.
You do the bowing now?
Yeah, do the bowing. Really? Yeah, people like it.
Really?
Yeah, and that's so coming from a club that wasn't doing it and now does it. And it took a while because everyone was like walking around like headless chickens. So I said, line up. They go, what do you mean line up? And it's like, because now with like Gracie Baja, they're very organized, and there is, you know, there is a structure and a strategy behind everything that they do. And then what they do is they try to work out from their own point of view what works best. Yeah. You know what I mean? And since I've started to make them changes, to be honest, and this is just my own what I've noticed, my retention rate's better.
Really?
My numbers have gone up. More people are coming more often.
That's very interesting.
Mm. And I know, because I've been keeping track more than ever before. And because, like, obviously, you know, how do we make money? Like, as jiu-jitsu guys, I teach them, right? So, you know, competitions don't pay, you know, nothing. You know, you've got to be winning all the time. It's about like being like a prize fighter. You've got to win to start even earning any type
if you're lucky.
Yeah, if you're lucky. So that's how we make our money, is by teaching private stuff like that. So the more people we can keep, because I always say, when you see them guys that say, yeah, well, you know, I'll get loads of people come in. How many stay?
Yeah,
because that you could have 5,000 people a month coming in.
If you have 5,000 leaving, you've got 0%.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's just basic mathematics.
Yeah.
So your retention rate is everything. And if people are getting scared off, if people are just not liking the format, not liking the structure, and people do like structure. It's really funny. I know there's that train of thought, like, yeah, let's all be radical, but people do like structure.
That really interests me. That intrigues me, you know, because I don't know. It's so hard when you're trying, when you have a group of so many 100, 200, 50, whatever, individuals to kind of get something that it's with the masses. And then I think what an important thing, you know, I don't bow. I don't do any of that sort of stuff. It's very, very laid back. It's very relaxed. I don't have them call me.
Yeah, that's the way
like
I
that.
Used to do it. That's you know.
But I think that, and I could be wrong on this, and the answer could simply be that structure, there's some sort of deep, intrinsic, evolutionary, psychological, subconscious thing that is actually humans crave structure, humans crave organization.
Men more so than women.
Yeah.
They like routine, structure.
That may be, and I do have structure in the classes and what we're doing and what we're following, just I don't get them to line up and bow. I get them to line up and I make them do push-ups if they've got their grading band. That's the only that's the only thing we do at the beginning of every class, which I guess is a, you know.
You only teach no-gi?
Yeah.
Really?
I only teach no-gi, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So like Ed Ingelmaus teaches all of the beginner's classes, Nick teaches the advanced classes, and I teach all of the no-gi, just no-gi.
You don't do gi anymore at all?
I don't teach any, I'm not on the books to teach any gi classes, no. And I haven't.
You missed the gi?
Yes. Yeah, I do. I do intend to train it. I haven't trained in the gi in a very, very long time. I was in Dubai for about a month in December, January time, and I trained a bit in the gi there.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I haven't really put the gi on in about 6 months, apart from to do a couple of privates. Just because time management.
It's annoying, but it's really nice for me because I've trained for like a lot of no-gi stuff, and I just, even if I'm teaching a class with a gi, at the end, take it off, roll without the gi.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, well,
it's nice. You know, it's like popcorn. When I ever go to cinema, I get sweet and I get salted popcorn. Because when you're having the salted and you get to the sweet, it tastes so sweet. And then when you've been eating the sweet and you get to the salted, it tastes so good. It's kind of like that. When you're training for gi and then you put the no gi on, then it feels good. And when you're training no gi, you put the gi on, it feels good. But I want to get back into the gi, but for the moment, I'm pretty focused on the no gi stuff and kind of improving.
Well, it makes more sense for the road that you're going
exactly,
down.
Exactly,
And it's like, you know, it's like we say, I mean, that's the thing, like competing in competitions and stuff like that for exposure, like doing the podcast competition, like wins or losses or whatever, is kind of gets your name out
exactly,
there. And hopefully, we always hope that it brings more people to the gym that allow, you know, they let us teach them, you know. Yeah. And that was, I was coming back to what I was saying earlier, is the same thing, is that's the only reason I competed was in the early days.
To put your name out there an instructor.
Well, no, to put jiu-jitsu's name out there in the early days, because it was all kind of, you know,
it wasn't established.
So we wanted to
needed to legitimize it.
It was that thing of like, let's keep on proving that jiu-jitsu works in MMA, or let's do, you know.
And you know what, I think that even though it's nowhere near the same level, it's very much accepted now how legitimate jiu-jitsu is.
Yeah.
There's still a degree, it's so young. Every single time someone new steps on the mat in a jiu-jitsu class, whether they've done nothing or even more so if they've done another martial art, you are representing jiu-jitsu and showing how effective it is every single time you roll with that person.
Yeah.
Which I find is a fascinating thing. And not just the instructors, but the students as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, what's great and different about jiu-jitsu compared to like coming from a very traditional martial arts background, it is how live it is, and you have to do it for real, and it's the evolution of it. It keeps on getting better, you know, and it does, it keeps on growing, and
it never gets stale.
No,
it doesn't. Which the problem with the lot of martial arts where they're too set in stone.
I'm learning stuff all the time, every day.
You can't not. It's infinite.
I'm like, I must kind of be close now. Nowhere near.
It's like the expanding universe, you know. Every year we see a little bit further into the universe, but by the time we see that, it's already expanded even more so.
Oh, absolutely. And that is the crazy thing with jiu-jitsu is, like, you know, 10 years ago I probably thought I knew a lot of jiu-jitsu, and really, and you know, even now I still feel like I'm at the beginner stages.
Yeah, the more you know, the more you know you don't know.
Yeah.
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 So I will let you go soon, because you need to get to SmackDown.
SmackDown WWE.
just before we go, any last words? First, give us information about how we can find out about you/your gym.
I mean, I'm on Facebook, Paul Bridges, or Gracie Baja Hastings.
You got a website?
Yeah.
I will link all of this stuff in the description.
www.graciebajahastings.com.
Okay.
And Instagram is Grace Baja Hastings. If anyone wants to come train, feel free. I mean, it's like every jiu-jitsu place. I mean, I've never known, you know, you kind of hear whispers and stories of bad jiu-jitsu places. I've never found a bad jiu-jitsu guy or place. You know, I've known a few dodgy people, but no, jiu-jitsu, I always say jiu-jitsu is great, and the people are even greater. And it's because I think, you know, anyone that sticks at jiu-jitsu and is long enough in it, especially when they have to go through the battles that you've gone through, I've gone through, on the mat, in the public eye, or you know, at competitions, especially when you've got students, stuff like that, looking at you and there for the world to see, and to kind of point a finger and either give you a cheer or hate online or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, the community is great. That's the thing I love about jiu-jitsu. Everyone's really cool. And, you know, and it's like I was saying earlier with that whole gi, no gi self-defense, just do it all, man. Just do it all. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, if you want, that's a great thing.
That's
you can choose.
It's a hobby. Do whatever you want.
Can you choose? Yes, of course you can.
Yeah.
Do you want to be this? No, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. Yeah. But don't be 100%. Hating on people that do. As I always say, when people come into jiu-jitsu and they've been doing it a while, and then they start taking like the mick out of like kung fu or aikido, and I'm like, look, it doesn't matter, because from my point of view, as long as them guys are happy doing that, that's it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, who am I to judge? I'm no one to judge. Yeah. It's like I'm doing this because I choose to do it.
Yeah,
it's like anything I do because I choose to do.
Yeah,
and it's like a conversation me and my wife had, and it sounded really funny to her, probably. And she probably should hit me, but I always say to her, but it's really true. I said, look, and I was talking about being together, and I said, look, if I didn't want to be here, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah, yeah.
Simple as that. Yeah. I would not be here. I'm here because I choose to be here. And it sounds kind of a bit funny, but no, because I want to be.
That's like a massive compliment.
But you know? I want to be. Yeah. And I'm one of them people. You'd know if I didn't want to be here because I wouldn't.
You're not going to do it.
Yeah. And it's the same with like the martial arts. I'm only doing jiu-jitsu because I want to do it. Because the way I feel about it, the same way I feel about my wife. That's why I'm with my wife, because the way I feel about her. And the way it makes me feel to be in the presence of, you know, either,
yeah,
or with people, like people in your life. I'm sure you've got people now that, you know, you used to be so tight with that you barely, yes, see anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And you lose that connection because it's not in the scope and the realm of where you want to be.
Yeah.
So you just move outside of that realm a little, yeah, bit. And not because you don't like that person, it's just you've moved into a different mindset.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like that. But I want to be doing jiu-jitsu until I'm a really old guy, until I drop down dead on the mat someday. And that's why, like, with me, it's like a marathon now. Mm. It's not about how hard I train, it's about how clever I train. And I've learned not to roll all the time. I still roll with all my students, but I don't roll all. I used to roll every single session, yeah, hard all the time. But as you get older, you just got to be, you know, more specific with your training.
Yeah.
Training, you know, as much. I'm on the mat all the time still, but I just don't see that, oh, I've got to roll with everyone, otherwise I'm not, like, legit, or they might think I'm ducking. I used to have that, like, yeah, I've got to roll because then I've got to give them my time and I've got to make sure that they get the best out of it. And realising they're all right rolling with each other, and I pepper in, and some days I roll with everyone, other days I feel like resting and stuff like that. But I can never understand the instructors that never roll.
No.
The jiu-jitsu instructors that never roll. And I've heard of a few.
No legit ones.
I don't know. I've heard of.
Really?
Yeah, but, you know, it's kind of. But the sources that it comes from, I'm thinking maybe they didn't want to roll with you.
Yeah.
maybe that's more
like.
You're
just an arsehole and they didn't want to roll,
yeah,
with you.
Yeah, so. Possibly. And they, you know. And people like that always want to talk. So I always think about both sides of the coin. Maybe they didn't roll the nights you were there, or maybe it was you, yeah, they didn't want to roll with.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can't understand, because I love it too much. I love rolling.
Yeah.
Like, I've been ill for like 3 weeks now. I've had, like, you can hear, like, this cold infection. Yeah. And I've not been able to train properly. And before that, I've had a few bad things in my hip and my spine and stuff like that, that I've kind of had to rest a little bit. And it drives me mad, mm, not being able to roll.
I know. And exactly.
It's on the side. I'm like, I want to roll.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though I'm getting older, I don't feel older, because I think it's because I still stay in the mix. Mm. I still do it. And I think if I just stopped, that's when I try to get back on the mat, and it would be maybe too much of a leap, yeah, back in time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
you're only as old as the people you roll with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And on that note, I'm going to let you, I'm going to run you back off to the station.
Okay. So hit, yeah, up, and WWE. I just want to say thanks for anyone that's listening. Thanks for Dan for
my
having me.
My absolute pleasure, mate. Really appreciate you coming on.
No. It's my pleasure. And only wish everyone the best. And if you see me at a competition or anywhere, if you want to hit me up on Facebook, I'm happy to speak about anything with anyone. Happy to have anyone come train with me. If you see me, say hello. I'm like everyone in jiu-jitsu, I'm a nice guy.
Yeah.
And you know, and hopefully not too many people hate about any comments that I've made or anything like that.
You've been fine, mate. You've been fine.
Okay,
don't worry about it. Thank you very, very much for coming on, Paul. Really, really, okay, appreciate it.
No, thanks for your time.
Nice one, buddy. Cheers. Cool, guys, that's it for this week. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Paul is a very cool dude. I really enjoyed chatting to him. If you want to find out more about him, you can look him up on Facebook, or his website for Gracie Barha Hastings is graciebarhahastings.com. So go check it out, and go drop in on him sometime if you're about the area. As usual, if you want to contact the podcast, you can email me on podcast@raspberry8.com. You can visit my website, raspberry8.com, to catch up with all the latest episodes, or buy merchandise, or just do whatever you want, I guess. You can also find me on various social media. I'm on Facebook, or you can follow me on Instagram @raspberry_ape. I will catch you guys next time. Take it easy.